Ho ho ho! And welcome to a very festive 23rd episode of the Crate and Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast, being recorded on the 18th of December. I'm Marsh Davis, and my four little helpers this evening are Tom Francis.
Yes, hello.
Tom Senior.
Alright.
Chris Thurston.
I signed up for none of this.
And Graham Smith.
Hello.
In that analogy, I am Santa Claus.
I got that.
Because it's the season of giving. Giving.
Given.
Given. Because it's the season of giving. We've prepared several prisings for you. One of which is the forum, newly opened, which you can access via our website. Obviously, there'll be a link in the show notes, but the show notes are on the website, so you could just click on the link that says forum. We've also made some lovely t-shirts for you to buy, all of which are themed around the titles of various different podcasts we've done, so they are rather cryptic, and in one case, slightly offensive. So,
three out of the four are bird themed.
Mm. Are they?
Because yeah. There's two owls and there's a duck.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that I don't know, maybe that's a trend in our titles as well.
Three owls, a duck, and a wizard.
Should we tell them what the titles are that they're based on?
No.
can't remember.
They can probably work them out. But if you like the podcast, or you just like watching men succumb to liver damage, you can buy them and support the podcast via money that way.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Also, just come and join the community because it's nice. And actually, it's grown pretty quickly since we opened it just this week.
And lots of interesting people on there.
Lots of nice people.
Very, very varied jobs, as it turns out.
Also, it just occurred to me, if you're listening to this in some sort of audio format that you didn't acquire from the website is crateandcrowbar.com, just because that's the essential fact underpinning everything we've just said.
Yes, so happy Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas.
At the end of the year, we usually look back on the year and see what things pleased us and displeased us. What things pleased you guys?
Oh, mostly video games.
I was going to say video games as well.
I was going to say alcohol. Yeah, alcohol and
animated gifts.
It's good that we have this podcast. Yeah. So, I have an obvious goatee, which I think we should always use there.
A very visible goatee.
And I also
gunpoint.
People can't not notice my goatee. but I've also, I've kind of played a bit of things that probably would be in my games of the year if I played them more. And the most recent one is XCOM Enemy Within, which I want to talk about a little bit. Because it's fucking awesome, but it's mainly awesome just because it's XCOM. And it kind of, it's just an excuse to play XCOM again. And all the new stuff is good. But mostly because I'm just starting out, really. I've only played, maybe 7-8 missions. I'm mostly just wrestling with the basics of just starting your XCOM career. But it reminded me how good it is. And some of the stuff they've added does add to kind of the personal element of it. I think it's almost compulsory to name your people after people you know. Just so that it has that extra kind of, you can project relationships onto it from real life about whether people know each other and whether people like each other. And then also you can project back from the game onto your friends and suddenly decide, I actually like this person a lot more because they've been doing really well in XCOM lately. Or I remember my last game, I also did the same thing, named them after people I know on Twitter. And one of them was Alex Wiltshire, former editor of Edge and a good friend of mine. And another one was Amanda Lange, who I don't know at all, but who follows me on Twitter. And they were the only two members of my initial squad that survived more than about 5 missions. Everyone else from the initial squad died. And obviously, because they were on every mission, they were getting promotions all the time. And so they became, the best troops in my whole team. And I also color-coded their uniforms, and I'm still doing that with my new game, where the initial squad is all white, and then the next squad is, green, and the next recruits are red or yellow. And so you can tell by looking at the team, oh, the white ones have been there from the beginning, and the green ones are, they're old hands, but they're not as experienced as the white ones. And so I just had these two white troops who are always in there and incredibly high level and kind of basically just nannied the whole team, would just kind of look after everybody and save everybody's ass all the time because they're so incredibly powerful. And I just, at some point I realized in my head, these two people are now married. These two characters of Alex and Amanda, clearly they're a married couple who have become joint team leaders and kind of run it like a family.
It's like a mom and pop XCOM unit.
Yeah. So I'm doing that at the moment and having great fun with Steve Gaynor and Anthony Birch. Steve Gaynor, the creator of, writer of Gone Home, and Anthony Birch, the writer of Borderlands 2, who already have a kind of mock Twitter rivalry in which they repeatedly tell each other to get on their level. And they're good friends, but it's fun to put them in the squad at the same time. So they were both new recruits at the same time, and they're the only two people to join the old team.
You haven't married them then?
No, instead I turn them into cyborgs. Because you can get the new thing in Enemy Within is you get the ability to capture this meld substance that lets you merge machine and flesh. And you buy this expensive lab, and then you get this rare resource, and then you can put a person into cyborg preparations, and it's going to take like 3 days to make them ready for cyborg implants, and then you'll have your mech, but then you have to actually buy the mech suit to put him into. And so it's a kind of a long and expensive process, and I decided to do it twice at once with both Anthony and Steve, and then have them both like join the squad of these horrible cyborgs. They're really ugly. They look really stupid. Because they cut off all your limbs for some reason, and then replace them with robot limbs. But those aren't the robot limbs you actually use. They just, like, you put those inside a bigger robot suit, and then use the bigger robot limbs to actually, like, punch people and hold heavy weapons. And they both look completely ridiculous, but it's great to have them both running around, and because they're like, obviously there's this rivalry between them. They always, as they level up, they're both technically the same class. But there's always two options when you level up. So they always take the opposite choice from each other. So Anthony's getting all of the defense upgrades and Steve's getting all of the attack upgrades. And yeah, it's just really cool. And then that just adds something to tactical situations when you realize, like, you want one of them to do, or one of them in a good position to do something, but you kind of, like, from a personality perspective, it's much more heroic if Anthony saved this person or received it.
You've created a buddy cop movie, basically, where they've got polar opposite skills, but they complement each other, and they're rivals, but they're best friends, and they're saving the world together. Mm. The Riggs and Murtagh of...
Robo buddy cop.
Yeah. Robro.
The
Robro cop. Sorry, I'm making a pie.
They're Mecha Birch and Cyber Gainer, attorneys at law.
Yes.
So, I guess... Should we do goatees now, or do we just talk about what we've been playing first?
Well, you guys want to talk a bit more about XCOM, don't you?
The game is great. I think I said everything I'm going to say about it in terms of my experience with it.
Because, would you make it your goatee?
No, I don't think so. Although I think I would rate it very, very highly, just as a game that really did kind of respect the amount of time you wanted to put into it. There's very little bullshit in XCOM, really. After maybe the initial 20 minutes of getting a new game started, it really does let you start making interesting decisions and shaping the kind of campaign you're going to have early, and then keep respecting that. And the results you end up with are your own, you know what I mean? And that is, I think, becoming increasingly important to me, the sense that I owned this campaign victory. I didn't simply push the correct buttons until the cutscene fell out. Games now.
We were talking just before the podcast about, I did a mission where you have to get to a certain beacon and activate it in order to call in an airstrike and then get out before the airstrike comes. And in my game, it was a disaster and I lost almost everyone, and only, one troop survived and activated the beacon, and then I had to sprint to the exit while I was being chased by chrysalids, and it was incredibly tense, and I kept getting surrounded every turn by like seven chrysalids, and they just about escape and get to the exit and leave. And then, Chris said, well, if you do die on the way out, it doesn't matter because you've called in the airstrike and the airstrike still happens, so you completed your mission and you lose your whole team. You don't get out alive at all, but the game just carries on. And I already had like a mission where I was supposed to rescue this really important VIP and he just got shot.
Yeah.
He just got shot to death by the aliens. And then my boss is like, oh, that was our only chance for this intel, and then come home. And I just kind of walk back to the extraction zone, and then the game just carries on. So it does and actually you can fail missions properly, and also there are missions where you can kind of screw them up, but then the game still carries on and you're still going.
Yeah. It's funny that you sort of, I always find the feeling of when your failures actually matter, it isn't just something you erase and try again. There's this immediate feeling of almost being put out, like, well, I don't have time powers. Every other game gives me time powers. Where are my nonsense time powers? And then you realize that actually it does make it so much more meaningful subsequently that, you know, hell, you did that wrong, you know. Congratulations. Now deal with it.
Yeah. Particularly when you get so attached to your troops, because then some of them die. When someone, it's so brutal, because they technically, when someone gets shot, they could get really badly injured, and that's a big deal in itself. They're going to be out of action when they get back to base, sometimes for weeks and weeks, and you're able to use them for a long time. Obviously, they're in danger. They might die in the next turn or something. But also, when they get shot, they might be critically wounded, and then they're bleeding out on the floor, and if you're lucky, you might be able to get to them with a medkit and stabilize them and then take them home, but they won't be able to fight in that mission. And again, they'll take ages to recover. But then when it just swaps on, it just says they died. And 90% of the time it is just they died. It's so like, fuck, that person's literally just completely gone forever. Everything I've invested in them, all those skills they put in, all the cool equipment they had, all the, like medals, you get medals now. I think they're new in Enemy Within. Where I don't know what they're caused by, but sometimes if you just do well, you get, you as a commander are given a medal to award to your troops and you decide who it goes to, which is great because then you have to actually think about who on that mission was, did stand out, which encourages you to kind of keep track of, oh, Jonty got lots of kills or this person did that heroic thing and see them as individuals rather than just, interchangeable troops. And those have little buffs as well, so they kind of affect their future performance too.
There's a, I think one issue with XCOM that they can maybe tweak a bit, which is you know you're boned when it goes into a little cutscene view before a shot is fired, because that only happens when someone is killed, or the very best thing that can happen from that point of view is wounded, and not every attack is going to wound. It's actually relatively rare compared to just straight up being killed. And so the kind of the moment when you go, oh shit, and you realize your favorite guy is gone is not when like the plasma round hits him in the face. It's when you see the camera zoom in on the alien that's about to do something, because it does this kind of like, this guy is about to kill someone you love.
He's about to fuck off him.
Yeah. And that, I think that presentation of that tend to just be like slightly more dramatic. It is dramatic, but I think maybe your focus is in slightly the wrong place when that happens. You know, you're then spinning the, you're fucked lottery, not the kind of like, what were the exact circumstances by which this happened kind of thing.
You know what I like about XCOM the most is how small scale it is, actually. If you actually, you remove the fluff of the world invasion event and all of the kind of, the story reason for what you're doing, you actually have probably a dozen characters that you're dealing with throughout the entire campaign, and all of your resource management is to do with, either, you know, you do some appeasing of other nations in terms of like throwing satellites up and stuff, but that's just to secure future resources and to prevent the game from ending. Actually, it's a story about these 12 or 15 characters, and it's not really a story about, it's not a grand strategy game, it's actually a very personal strategy game in which you form relationships. And it's easy to forget that when you're playing because the presentation is so good, generally. But I love this idea of a strategy game that's just about a narrow handful of people, and I'd love to see more of that. It's surprisingly hasn't been iterated on that much, has it, really? There aren't many other games like XCOM.
No. I mean, I think that was the key to... I mentioned this in a previous podcast that my campaign, the one that got to the end, finally bugged out on an unresolved game-breaking bug on the final mission. And the only way to resolve it on an Iron Man playthrough is to use a ability that you get right at the end, a psychic ability that can be used to do friendly fire, to wipe out your entire squad so that you fail the mission. And it's a special mission. It's the last mission in the game. So that you can then start it again with a different squad that you might have to then level up. And that was suggested to me, I think, in a comment after that episode had gone up. But the point of XCOM is those six people that went into the final mission, not just beating it, right? Like I'd seen the final cutscene before. I wasn't interested in simply beating the game. I was interested in seeing those characters end it. And the fact that I won't get to do that, it was kind of like, oh, well, I'll just leave it here. Like, I could imagine what would have happened.
You didn't want to see the dramatic but slightly surreal climax of their story where one of the team just randomly kills all the others.
Someone on the A team randomly kills the rest of the A team. And the B team trains up for like three missions and then goes into a bizarrely similar, especially because XCOM, without spoiling anything, ends on a kind of chosen one type thing with one of your squad, you know, to then have like, and then there was a different chosen one. It was this guy instead. And the alien narration thing at the end where he's like, you have proven, and also this guy has proven it as well. Yeah, this is all fine. Everybody, there we go. Oh dear. Yeah. No, that game's pretty awesome. I was going to talk about a game that sort of I didn't start off liking at all and was going to be, I was absolutely miles away from anywhere near a goatee, just the, you know, a clean shaven game if there ever was one. But now is sprouting some little hairs.
Okay, let's go far enough.
Okay, next time. Which is Hearthstone. Which I started off seeing as kind of unfair, maybe even a little bit pay to win, kind of, or at least a gambling game, you know what I mean? Simply about putting coins into a machine until, you know, trumpets and victory and fireworks fell out. But actually, there's a really good, accessible, competitive card game in Hearthstone that you don't have to spend any money on at all to get quite a lot out of, especially since the recent patch with added quite good ranked play, which sort of runs parallel to the arena mode that was, you have to pay to enter. We're going to post about this on the forums as well, and I think almost everyone who plays that game is going to go through a emotional kind of curve where it seems like bullshit. Like, at first you're like, wow, this is so fun and tactile, and all the cards are like, wow. And then it's like, every card is a prick, and I hate everyone playing this game, and this class is completely overpowered, and how do you beat this, and this is impossible, how do you beat this, where you have to build a counter for it, but you never know what opponent card deck your opponent's going to use. And then you get past that into a little bit more game knowledge and a little bit more awareness of how its systems lock together and what's possible. And maybe you read an odd guide. And then it becomes really, really fun again. And it's sort of interesting wondering how Blizzard are going to make that journey less difficult for people. Because I think it's already explosively popular, and no doubt a lot of people listening to this have already played it. But there's going to be a huge influx of people next year. You know, and it's going to be one of, I guess I really can't even make it a game of this year because it's only in very closed beta, but there's going to be this huge influx of interest in it, and I think there's going to be a wall of people hitting that wall of bullshit feeling all at once. And
wall of people hits a wall of bullshit, and a thousand voices cry out.
It's another loud squelching sound, and then crying. And it's going to be interesting to wonder if the massive hype for that game is not going to result in this kind of huge equal backlash when people hit that feeling when they first get wiped out by a card they can't see a possible counter to. The way the game works, basically, the level where once you push through this stuff, and the thing people should realize is that it's not really about having a plan of your own. It's about having a power curve for your deck, or, you know, an order you can play cards in that builds something you're aiming for, which is usually winning. But playing so that the other guy is always reacting to you. And I think that I sort of settled on that as the core of everything I find interesting in competitive games. It's what I've gotten out of Counter-Strike, which I imagine we'll be talking about in a bit. It's also what I get out of Dota, is that feeling of like, I'm in control of the pace of this competition. And Hearthstone actually has a really satisfying way of sort of enacting that, when you know it well enough that you know what the other guy's dickhead card is, right? Like, you know what his 10 mana asshole move is. And so it's not even a case of baiting it out, but responding to it in a way that, you know, on the other side of the internet, he's calling you a dickhead. And that is the most satisfying experience. One of the most satisfying experiences it's possible to have with the game, in my experience, especially because there is no chat, right? There's no flaming in Hearthstone. You have a little radial menu of emotes that you can do. And in that circumstance, silence can mean something, but also someone going, thank you. Thank you. Thank you can mean something as well. Like, you know, or, you know, the only dick move in Hearthstone is to go, oops, when the other person makes a mistake. but that kind of like almost like semaphore trying to give someone the middle finger of the internet is kind of, again, really kind of charming and very enjoyable. But maybe I just have the wrong, get the wrong things out of playing games, but that's really good for me.
Limited communication in multiplayer games. It's fun in Journey, where you only have one thing you can do. You just make a little bing thing and just try to communicate.
What's the kind of middle finger equivalent in Journey?
It's I guess it's like bing 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 bing.
Yeah. But yeah, it's and there's like a tremendous amount of probably unnecessary artistry in it, which I didn't kind of figure out until later on, where like every card, and you only find this if you went into your collection and clicked on the cards and then clicked on another thing, every card has a really funny description. Like all that kind of old Blizzard humor that sometimes feels like it's not, you know, not as prominent a part of their output anymore. And probably still there, it's just their output's so much bigger. But yeah, every card has a really funny description. Some of the art is really nice. The feel of the thing is great. And Arena, which used to feel like a casino to me. Arena, what it means is you pay a certain amount, or you can pay in-game currency that you earn by doing certain things. So you either grind the entry fee or you pay £1.50. Is you enter a mode where you get given a choice of three cards, and then another choice of three cards, then another choice of three cards until you've built an entire deck. So you build an entire deck that has nothing to do with your regular cards you own. And then you attempt to win games with that deck against other people who've built decks in the same way. And the more games you win, the bigger rewards you get when you kind of cash out. And if you win three in a row, if you lose three at all, you're out. And that your run is over. And so it feels a little bit like gambling, right? Like, cause it, you know, the deck building feels kind of arbitrary, and then the, and then the battles feel a bit weird because everyone has a kind of weird mishmash of different kinds of cards. And, you know, you think, well, where's the strategy level gone? Where's the deck construction level gone? But it's actually a really nice equalizer as well, that you put all of, you know, no matter how much money you've spent in building up your collection otherwise, or no matter how much time you've put into regular ranked play, it's a equal playing field where you make the best of the cards that the random deck builder gave you, and then attempt to execute on the same kind of strategies you would normally. And sometimes it does feel like bullshit. But when you stop seeing it as, this is bullshit because the game hates me, and start seeing it as, like, just sort of like, everyone's weird improvisation with materials trying to make strats happen, it becomes really kind of tactical and interesting. And fun to watch, actually, which I would never have expected from a card game. Like, you can watch it on Twitch or whatever and actually get something out of it. With the right guide, I guess.
Yeah, I think the, thing is, there's nine different heroes with nine different deck styles.
Yeah.
And each of those decks have many different ways of kind of, you can build them in many different ways to accentuate their style. And for a new player, there's no way of gaining purchase on that level of complexity. So you're just kind of playing cards idly for hours before you possibly get into it. And each deck has 20 basic cards that you have to unlock by playing.
Yeah, that is bullshit.
And basically you're going to be ineffective until you have all of those, because they're kind of integral to many of the styles that you're going to want to play with. Mm. It's an interesting tutorial thing, because when you see cards unlocking, you think, oh, that's what this deck is supposed to do, because they'll be themed in a certain way. They might be like big tank creatures, and you think, oh, remember, that's what a mage is supposed to do, maybe. And it gives you a clue, but at the same time, you're without those cards before that point, and you're going to get fucked up.
Yeah. That said, though, that's not entirely the case. Like, I thought that for a while as well, and then yeah. I think that's the weird thing. That's going to be the everyone's experience of Hearthstone is, this seems like bullshit, and then, like, a few hours later, you realize the very specific way in which it might not always be bullshit, which is, it is fully possible to win without having all of those basic cards. Like, you actually do get fairly quickly the core of whatever that build is, but that's more true for some classes than others.
Mm.
Like, priests, you can start priesting up. Priests are really hard to beat for characters that don't know how to beat priests, which is going to be most new players, because they can heal themselves and do crazy shieldy buffy things with their minions. They get all of the stuff they need by the level 4, and then the stuff you get after that is like even more just sort of specialized kind of dickery, including their most hated card, which is called Mind Control, and it just allows you to take any of the enemy's minions that you want. So you just hold on to that for a while, and then...
Yeah, they've made that more expensive in the last patch.
Yeah, they did.
Understandably so, because it's the most infuriating move. Yeah, it's really, really good. I mean, I used to play a lot of Magic the Gathering, and it has a similar system, really, in that if you're going to play at very high level, you have to have a certain number of very rare cards. And actually gaining access to those rare cards is not straightforward, because you buy packs. The packs give you randomized cards that you can melt down for crafting material that you can then eventually turn into a rare card. And that is going to get incredibly expensive. And it's kind of a way of obfuscating the price of being allowed into that top tier, which seems dodgy to me, really, as a way of structuring a free-to-play model. It's completely reasonable to charge people who want to get to that level money, but to do it in such a obscure way feels wrong to me.
Yeah, I guess the thing that needs to be kind of confirmed at that top level is how necessary those cards are. Like, how much of it is kind of like current metagame orthodoxy?
That's true. I think cards like Headcrack for Rogue is just an essential part of dealing damage to enemies. You just gotta have it, at the moment. But again, the meta can shift in the way that
that's the thing. And that'll be the interesting thing, when people are really invested in getting particular cards because of what they saw a pro player do on a stream, and then the balance of the game shifts and those cards are no longer.
And whenever Blizzard are they just going to trickle new cards into it, aren't they, to gradually shift that stuff? They've done this so well with StarCraft 2 patches, where they've just changed such subtle things that have just unbalanced things a little bit, and then to give the community something to react to. And they keep their communities reacting all the time. And that's kind of the genius of how Blizzard run their high level, like in World of Warcraft as well. And they'll certainly do that with Hearthstone.
I think that'll be the satisfaction of the game as well. It won't ultimately be about grinding out the perfect deck that will win you every game you ever want. It will ultimately be always about, like, reacting and kind of responding. And that's actually why I like Arena, because Arena gets rid of everything like that, apart from the entry fee, and equals the deck a bit, but notwithstanding.
I like that it's got a griffin in the corner of one of the boards, that when you poke his head, he looks at your pointer.
Yeah.
How cute that is.
It is good, yeah. You can break windows in a church.
Yeah.
You can set a little fire. You can just click on things on the board and shit happens.
Yeah, set things on fire and ding a bell and...
It's good. On. Yeah.
Yeah.
internet wizard cards. They're okay. Marty.
Hello. Hello.
Sorry, you were drinking.
Go for it.
What has stood out to you in this, the year of our Lord 2013?
The year of Luigi.
I was thinking about this. I think actually, all the games that are likely contenders for Game of the Year, I have somehow managed not to play. Like, I haven't played Total War, I haven't played any of the kind of big strategy games that came out this year, and the games that I've been most enjoyed seem like fairly disposable things, or things that kind of already existed. For example, I really loved the Brigmore Witches, but that's DLC for a game that came out last year, and I really like Counter-Strike, but it's a bit kind of a stretch to say it came out this year.
Yeah,
So I think we should talk about Counter-Strike, but I, by process of elimination, the fact that I can't nominate Gunpoint, I think probably Gone Home is,
Oh, cool.
It's probably my game of the year. But I feel bad saying that, because it feels like, not because it's a bad game in any way, but because I feel like a game of the year should be something you invested in, really, like loads of hours and really got taken over by. Whereas Gone Home is, in its nature, an ephemeral, ephemeral?
Super ephemeral.
I ephemeraled the fuck out of it. Yeah, it's brief. It's what I meant to say.
Mm.
But it's, yeah, good story. And that's all there is to it, really. It's just it's a good and interesting narrative.
Yeah.
As a game, not the most interesting kind of mechanically that you'll find. I think it does justify itself as a game rather than just a narrative, because I think the way that you scrabble for little bits of information and your interaction with that environment is part of the kind of the mood of that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, like, the story was better because a lot of it happened in my head by piecing things together. Like, sometimes a particular piece of information is not written in any of the notes. It's the fact that you found this note and then you read this other note. You can, if you connect the two, you realize, that's happening. And so the fact that the story is delivered in that kind of deducive way is really cool.
Yeah.
But fuck it. Counter-Strike's better.
Counter-Strike is also a drama of information. Only yes. Instead of it being who is sleeping with whom or is there a ghost, it's where is the man and is he going to kill me?
Usually yes is the answer to that in my case. Yeah.
Over there and yes.
Why did I fire at him and miss him is the question I asked.
Yeah, yeah. So man, often. Counter-Strike's really, really good.
It's great, and I'm still not very good at it, but I don't think I've enjoyed a multiplayer game in many, many years, as much as I've enjoyed going back and playing Counter-Strike.
Is this Counter-Strike Go?
Yes. Global Offensive.
Is that now the definitive version?
It's hard to say, really, isn't
it? Because when it came out, it seemed like a bit of an extra limb. It seemed like Counter-Strike Source was still really good, and all the changes seemed a bit
weird. The matchmaking makes Go the version that you would play. Right. Like, I mean, I guess there are going to be really competitive people who have their favourite version from before. But I think
it's the one that's being supported by, you know, all their microtransactions and stuff, so it's kind of really valved.
That's what makes it better. Microtransactions.
No.
It's one that's being updated that gets new maps.
And,
yeah. I think they should have called it Counter-Strike Still in Source.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, is it still in Source. It's still got all the same source glitches. Source ladders. Jesus Christ.
Source ladders are a mechanical feature of that game, right? Yeah. Like, that's a strategy people use, is their ability to run backwards into a ladder and magically fly up into the air. Because that's how ladders work. Like, they're just a magic frictionless surface that goes up and down.
Yeah, they're sort of frictionless yet sticky.
Yeah.
So they get stuck on them, but they also...
It's that thing when everybody starts from the spawn and you all run off in the same direction at pretty much the same run speed. And because your bounding boxes are just in collision with each other, everybody kind of jerks back and forth really rapidly. And obviously, good players know to space themselves. But it does seem like, why is that still in
the
game?
The thing.
But it's because it's become something now. It's become something that people need to react to, and it's become valuable as a kind of, you know, thing to respond to.
But it feels like that's the thing where, you know, and this is also happening in the era where, you know, Battlefield 4 has gone from, like, a little bit disappointing to actively quite seriously broken. In multiplayer, you know, people are very cross about it. The people who make petitions are making hella petitions. And yet Counter-Strike, you know, Battlefield fixes all the problems of you don't run up against another dude and be all like jerky. But,
but it doesn't. Motto, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't. Battlefield 4, doesn't have that. You know, that's been fixed, but it hasn't actually captured any of the kind of for me at least, the drama or
kind of lethality.
Yeah,
my favourite is the bit just after the map has kind of finished loading, and whatever sound is about to play will just stutter and loop like 16 times before it actually starts.
They don't do that anymore. They fixed that one.
Yeah, it does do it occasionally for me.
Okay, a little bit of nostalgia.
Yeah,
there's a patch recently that fixed the camera height, so it was actually the same height as your face. People were getting shot in cover because the camera height was slightly lower than their face.
That's a horrible thought, like your eyes are coming out of your mouth and your head gets blown off because you don't know your head is sticking up there.
Yeah, that's one of the many disappointing...
Wearing your face on your head.
Was that a Battlefield 4 glitch?
Sorry, that's Big Beer 4, yeah.
Oh, right. Right. Okay.
That's certainly not Counter-Strike, yet.
Yeah, my God, they would go insane.
Stormed Valve HQ if that, that would happen.
Yeah.
So, I've started playing Global Offensive. I played it when it first came out. I've gone back to it now. And I love it. And you expressed a little bit of weariness about calling it your game of the year, because I think it came out last year and it's still Counter-Strike. And that's just that, I have that overwhelming feeling when I'm playing the game, because I've been playing Counter-Strike, I realize now, for about 15 years? For, I guess, a little bit less than that, maybe like 12 and a half, 13 years, which is just nuts. I can't play certain maps of Counter-Strike without remembering being a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
And there is no other game that quite gives me that same experience. Like, even though the maps have been updated in terms of their appearance, it feels very odd to revisit.
It's weird, like, I didn't realise how much I remembered. Like, you know, I played that game religiously when I was a teenager as well. Obviously, Counter-Strike 1.2 or World War 1, I guess. And, like, my friends who have come to Counter-Strike with Go, from Dota, or you were saying there's something similar, Martin. That, so the learning the ways in which weapons differ, right? Yeah. Like, learning that this is where you need to roughly aim an AK for recoils up and hit someone in the head. This is how the M4 is different. This is how the AUG is different. And, you know, this is, like, how they all feel. Those are, like, when I first started hearing that, I was like, that's obvious. Like, the M4 is like, and the AK is like, bah! Like, and like, and I realized I have this, like, really, like, physical sense of how all those guns differ, even though they're not, like, you know, like, they're not incredibly impressive animated models. There's no real sense of, like, power. Not in the same sense that maybe COD gives you this sort of tremendous, like, recoil and, like, heft to the guns you're firing. Mm. But every single gun in Counter-Strike has a physical identity that hasn't really changed over the years, that I know incredibly, and like, that has been like drilled into like the strata of my brain where I'll never forget things. So, which is kind of weird that, like, you know, that could have been given over to being able to play the piano, but no, it's this, you know, it's the, oh, this is like, you know, this is what you're capable of doing really quickly with an M4, whereas, you know, the, like, the stair org is more like a spiky kind of, slightly broader, more kind of, like a hedgehog of a gun, you know? Like, the AWP is a little rabbit. No, the M4 is like a rabbit. Right. Like, you know, I like think smooth and direct.
I think if the Krieg is like a sword.
Yeah.
It's like really accurate, but also quite fast firing. So it's like
sustained a sword.
Damage, yeah. Like a just sword. Like a sword. Yeah. Like, you know when you're firing like a sword sort of 3 times a second?
Yeah, whereas like the, you know, the AWP is like, there's nothing worse than missing.
Like a gun.
Yeah. There's like this moment where you miss and there's like this physical tension of waiting for the game to decide you can fire again as you strafe or whatever, or move or crouch or do whatever you need to do, especially if you're sort of sniper dueling someone. That kind of moment has, like, is, that delay is drilled into my brain. Like, that interval of, I'm fucked, I'm fine! Like, that's, that, like, thing is just so kind of palpable that you wonder if any game can ever kind of do it again. Like, you know, it's not just about having more weapons or new sets of weapons to unlock or attachments for guns and things. Mm. Like, you have to actually be able to convince people of the, like, identity of the things they're using, the tools in the game, to have that kind of influence, I think.
It has fewer guns than almost any other shooter, I think. I think that's where each gun can have its own space, because Battlefield 4, it doesn't have an unlock tree, you know, that they have to sustain with a dozen weapons for each class. And like Call of Duty's weapons, they have so many weapons because they're designed to keep people playing and unlocking. But then those weapons feel quite alike, and there's no real differentiator between them. Whereas Counter-Strike has always had these famous weapons, and that they've become so well known because they're so low to add to them. Like, everything must have its role. Everything must have its purpose. And that makes it worthwhile as opposed to just being a casual implement.
Mm. I fired an AK-47 in real life, many years ago. And I was quite taken aback by how unlike Counter-Strike it was. They only fired like a single burst, like a, you know, but it was obviously a substantially heavier thing than a thing that has no weight, and louder and scarier and everything else. But I think I'd gotten such a strong sense of what an AK-47 was from that game particularly. And, you know, the AK-47s of the early noughties in FPSs would be an interesting, like, cross-study. Like, the identity of the AK-47 as the slightly less accurate, kind of more powerful assault rifle compared to the American one. But firing it, I was like, I know what this is going to be like. Great, I'm going to aim slightly below the guy. It's going to kick up into his head.
Shooting
and then
a man.
Like, holy God, it's massive and really, really loud. But I think I've been so convinced by, because that representation of the gun is convincing, right? Like, it's convincing because it's very, very, very specific.
It's a weird case though, because most games now, if you were going to do an AK-47, you would go record the AK-47 being fired from six different directions and mix the sound together from that. Whereas Counter-Strike was a mod made by people in their spare time in their bedrooms, so they didn't have the resources to do that. And the AK sound now is the same as it's always been. It's been carried forward and it's never been updated, because the second you do, the Counter-Strike community goes nuts because it no longer feels like Counter-Strike anymore.
Sorry. What was the first game to decide that shotgun's shot turns into like millet about, you know, maybe Quake. 20 paces or something? Yeah, it must have been Quake, I suppose.
Because, I mean, the shotgun's quite effective in Doom.
It only had like four pellets in it and like a horizontal line.
Because that is now just the status quo for shotguns in any game. Even like military shooters, shotguns are just not effective at range.
But that's not true.
This is not true, no. Which is why clay pigeon shooting is an effective sport.
Otherwise, it's not people like running down on a clay pigeon and like taking it down,
down in an alleyway somewhere.
Yeah. And it's kind of the point, isn't it? Isn't the reason it fires so many pellets is so that you get a spread and therefore you hit many things? Like,
because being hit by a hot,
at long
fast
range.
Metal thing at any range is going to do something to you. You know what I mean?
It's like if you use a shotgun at point blank range for any of its intended purposes, it's useless. There's no point in making it a splitting pellet, because it didn't split very much. Should have just fired a bullet.
I love shotguns in Rainbow Six Vegas. They were stupidly ineffective for tactical shotguns, which is like, the people who use tactical shotguns, like the SWAT teams, they use it for precision. But these are the least precise shotguns I've ever fired in a game. It was almost prohibitive to take them into battle. They're like muskets of old.
Like SWAT guys lining up in a musket
round. Yeah, that's right. It's like row fire. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
When I was working on a Quake 2 mod, we had a long range shotgun in it, where the spread kind of like, it was a spread, but it was a very tight spread and just kind of stayed the same over range for some reason. It was really satisfying to use.
I thought Red Orchestra 2, like Rising Storm, was it this year?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's got fucking brilliant guns in it.
Yeah.
They're like tripwire obsessed with guns, and they fire them a lot and they know what they're like, and you really get a sense of how deadly they are when you're playing that game. Just one bullet can kill.
Yeah, their guns, like Killing Floor's guns as well.
Dev.
They feel fucking amazing.
Yeah, the handguns in that game are just,
like, you might feel guilty about saying this, like, if as an otherwise kind of critic of video games and maybe want more from the medium than just the feeling of holding a gun and being like, yes! But like, all of their games produce that feeling in almost anyone. Like, you know, you could sit down the most ardent, detractor of the modern military shooter in all its forms and give them the lever action rifle from Killing Floor and they'll miss it when they play Gone Home. You know? Like,
can't headshot the television.
No.
Greyhelm.
Hello.
What would be your game of the year?
Well, similar to Counter-Strike, it's a game which I feel slightly awkward picking because it's Spelunky HD, which I first played in 2009 when the free PC version came out, and it sort of defined 2010 for me. And then I spent much of 2012 playing because it came out on the 360 then, and we would play it co-op in the office. But I think that this year is the year that I realized that basically, it's just my favourite game ever. Like, Spelunky's just taking that spot now. And I'll justify it by pointing to the daily challenge mode, which was new this year. And the most fun I had this year was both playing that and the tension of it, and then watching the videos of all my friends doing it on the Spelunky Explorers Club every single day, spending 2.5, then three and a half hours a day just trying to keep up with videos until it no longer became efficient anymore. And the more I like, I haven't played it in, like, 2 or 3 months now, but I still think about it every single day, and the more I think about it, the more I like it, and I'm excited by it. Like, it's not diminishing in my mind at all. And this was a year for me, which I think maybe similar to you, I looked at the lists of the contenders for, like, Game of the Year stuff and thought, well, of these 25 games, I've played 6 of them, and most of the games I played and really enjoyed this year were stuff like Kerbal Space Program, which is an alpha and constantly being updated, but it came out last year and it was a thing I talked about then and a lot of that kind of stuff.
I'll chime in now because my answer is exactly the same. It's Blunky, and it's also because of the PC version and also because of primarily the Daily Challenge, which is like, Blunky was already game of all the years it's come out in. But the Daily Challenge just completely changed it. It like became an entirely new thing. Like, that is a game in itself, and created a kind of like culture, really. Like, there's a whole, you know, we have a little society of people playing all the time. And also, I finally completed it. I haven't done everything you can do, but I've done the proper run through where you go through hell and all the secret stuff. Not all secret stuff. You can't ever say that about Spelunky, because only one person has ever done the eggplant run. And I took a break from it after that. It was the first kind of significant break I've had from it in a long time after I finally completed hell. And I just kind of didn't feel the urge, the need to play it like every day or anything. Cause I'd done what I set out to do. Like, I've done the thing now. That was the thing to do. And so there wasn't a remaining challenge to conquer. And I've just started going back to the last couple of days, just kind of as what it originally was for me, which is a break game. A thing to play in like 5-10 minutes when, you're not really in the mood to like get stuck into something for hours. And, it's now just really kind of relaxing to play. It sounds ridiculous, but I don't get angry when I die anymore. Like, I'm just kind of, I've gone beyond death. And now, when I die in an absurd way, I'm just going, ha! That's hilarious. Like, yesterday I died, running towards there's a poisonous snake on a little platform, and I think it was just like a jar past it, or maybe like a single gold ingot, was worth like $500. And I was trying to run across the gap, because if you're sprinting, you don't fall down a gap, whilst whipping. So that when I came in contact with the spitting snake, I would be whipping and kill it, rather than it kill me. And also I had to time it so the spitting snake was looking away from me, and also I couldn't stand on the platform when it was looking towards me, and I had to jump up onto my platform when it was looking away, then do the sprint, then do the whip at the same time. And I did all that, and I fucked it up because I didn't hold down sprint because I was holding too many other buttons, and I slipped down the crack, and just, there's spikes directly below it, and my character automatically hung on to the other platform. And I was like, holy shit, that could have been really bad. All I'm doing is like this stupid 500 bar gold, and I nearly just kill myself permanently. This is like way into a really promising run. And so I dropped down, hung onto another platform, went around spikes, then jumped back up and did it again, and this time I fell on spikes. I made exactly the same mistake, but this time I didn't grab onto the edge. I just died. And I wasn't at all frustrated, I was just like, ha! And that was the end of my daily challenge. But it's really interesting watching lately, watching people who are still doing the daily challenge, and in particular like Chris Remo, and Anthony, I think, I'm not sure if he's still doing it now, but he was until quite recently. And both of them have at some point during the videos I've watched come to the conclusion, this is the best game ever made. this is actually the best game of all the games ever. including all the things you're nostalgic about and stuff. And it's really interesting because Chris was very skeptical about it. I remember him talking about it on Idle Thumbs, like after the first few times he played it, and he's just like, yeah, I like it, but I just don't really kind of get it in the same way everyone else does. And I think there is a moment when you kind of get to, when you start to understand things that felt more random are actually avoidable, and things that felt unfair are a bit fairer than you realized, and you get that basic kind of, muscle memory down for dodging certain, like, trivial enemy types, because when you're still getting killed by bats after your 1,000th bat, they're quite annoying. But then after you kind of, once you get to the point where they're not always killing you, it's sometimes something else, or sometimes you actually like whip a bat even in quite a tricky situation, and you start to get more into kind of the, you play it enough to see the really rare situations, like holy shit, there's just a jetpack in the rock just embedded in the level. And so you blow it up and you get it and you've got a jetpack and it's fucking magical. And all the weird like confluences of strange things like dark black markets and you know, shopkeepers who are already angry when you enter the level, or suddenly finding a level just flooded with spiders because something destroyed an altar. Yeah, I think that there's... I don't exactly know what it is, except for all the stuff we've already talked about it being richly systematic and incredibly, consistent, and random generation keeping it fresh. But it's really gratifying to see different, very different people kind of get to that point where they suddenly go, oh, this is the best game! It's actually the best, it's not just kind of quite cool, it's like really fundamentally, eternally good.
I feel the need to stress that Hearthstone isn't my game of the year.
Oh, right, okay.
Dota is my fucking game of the year. I just yeah. I figured the embargo on me talking about Dota was still in place, so I'm not going to talk about it.
We have to talk about it when it's the game of the year.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, like, no way. Hell is Hearthstone my game of the year. Jesus Christ. I think it's quite a good game. No, it's Dota, obviously.
It came out like, didn't it sort of officially come out like a week ago or this year.
I mean, I could.
Go on. It's all Christmas.
Right. I feel big because I feel like there's people who are going to be listening to this who listen to me talk about Hearthstone. Like, what? Like, what happened? Like, you went to BlizzCon. Well, like, he's just been activated. Like,
we transitioned gradually from what we've been playing into Game of the Year.
Yeah, I guess maybe that was it. Because, like, Hearthstone's what I've been playing recently that isn't Dota, but what I play is Defense of the Ancients 2, the Defense name. And, like, it's been, like, there's an amazing, almost rough patch for the game, where Valve went very silent after the game was released for a long time. They said that they were going to slow down updates a little bit. The beta was beta and it had its own update schedule and new heroes are going to be released every so often. And then after the game was quote unquote done, they did the first kind of big update, TF2 style update, you know, where they kind of roll out a whole bunch of content under a theme at once. And then they went silent for ages. And then famously the Halloween event didn't materialize quite when people thought it would. And people started harassing car manufacturer Volvo because of a famous misspelling of Valve that has meant that the community calls Dota Doto and Valve Volvo. But, like, Volvo's, like, beleaguered Twitter manager, whoever that person is, dealing with, like, millions, like, more followers than they've ever had, like, millions of people requesting Diatide. And Valve, since then, have kind of opened up in a way that is quite engaging, where they've just realized that they really do need to actually communicate to people, and they might not have someone whose job it is to do that, but they still actually need to do it. So, and they've always, I think, had fun teasing events and things. That's true of TF2 as well, and kind of like seeding the kind of the making following the game fun, as well as making the game itself enjoyable. And, I was telling you about this for lunch of the day, Marsh, so forgive me for repeating the same story, but, a really nice example of this is this recent spate of changes to heroes, redesigns, renames in some cases, which are basically pretty obviously designed to put some distance between Valve and Blizzard for when Heroes of the Storm comes out. They know, I think, and I very much doubt, and I have no inside track on this, it's just theory. I very much doubt an email, anyone's been knocking at their door telling them to change heroes. What I suspect is they've realized that the reality of a Blizzard lane pushing game is now upon them, and they would do well to just remove themselves further and further from the kind of the Warcraft 3 route to the game where they can. So that's meant like renaming characters who previously had names that were quite close to Warcraft characters, something else, recoloring characters who looked otherwise like, other characters. The most substantial change is happening, it happened now, where a character was, essentially what's happened is Skeleton King, he's a skeleton and a king, is now, who looks a lot like the Skeleton King from Diablo, that's the, you know, what he was based on, is now the Wraith King, who is more like a kind of undead, you know, kind of immortal kind of monarch. It looks more like a Chuck, actually. It looks like Regal Chuck would be how I'd describe him. But rather than just do a patch and sort of roll that out, they did a patch where the only patch note was Skeleton King has been removed from the game for pressing ceremonial reasons. Like, no other patch, but done as a serious Steam patch note. Like, and nothing else in that patch. And then they kind of announced the Frostivus, which is the annual Dota Christmas, which is supposed to be an event where everyone gives each other presents, there's no more fighting, everyone gets on, you know, it's about friendship and love and everything else. And every year, Frostivus gets cancelled. Like, last year it was cancelled by the Grieveling, which was the little goblin creature stealing Christmas and everyone having to fight each other for the presents that are left. And this year it was done as a sort of signboard about Frostivus that had a big notice pinned on it the day after it went up, which just said, Frostavis is cancelled by the decree of the only king that matters. And they've set up this thing, which is that once every Christmas or Blue Moon, Skeleton King has this opportunity to do a ritual that will restore his body. And so they've built an entire new game mode around, which is Lua scripted, which is interesting because it suggests that custom game modes are going to come to Dota. Where it's like a holdout horde defense co-op PvE mode. It's actually really fun. Where you defend Skeleton King for waves and waves and waves at the end of the game. He transforms into his new form and fights you. And that's the kind of the introduction of the hero. But the fact that they've built this kind of big, kind of fun sort of Christmas event thing where you can win prizes and things around distancing themselves slightly from someone else's intellectual property is kind of a testament to why that game, I think, has such an enduring role in people's lives beyond the mechanical stuff I've spoken about before, beyond the value of something really competitive or something that you invest a huge amount of time in learning. It's that following it feels like kind of being in on a joke or a kind of little cultural thing. And that's been true of a lot of games, I think, over time. Like, it's why people would throw a fit if the AK-47 Counter-Strike sound effect was ever changed, because it's part of the fabric and the character of that game. But the changing fabric of the game is now kind of like part of the fun of following it. And as sort of things change and characters get added and everything else. And, that notice board, the same notice board with the notices were pinned to, other notices were pinned to it as well. And they teased different heroes that weren't in the game yet, and one of them was subsequently added, and people are kind of picking it apart and doing the kind of Valve fan thing of trying to find hidden messages
I saw that notice board and I reinstalled Dota. Like, because it was such that thing of, this feels like a thing where everyone who really likes Dota is gonna fucking love this.
It's Christmas.
It's like, yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like Christmas for you, basically. The game that you loved has got a bunch of cool new stuff in it, and it was presented in a really fun way. And it took me back to when I used to play lots of Team Fortress 2, yeah. And every class update would do the same thing, and there would be new modes, and there would be presented via a website, and there would be a new short film to reveal it, and it was just, being a part of that always felt really exciting, and piling in with your friends to explore and play and experience the new thing, and feel like the thing you loved was
living in some way.
Yeah, and changing, and the people who were making it were, that it was alive, basically, in a way which Team Fortress 2 doesn't feel alive anymore. And I know they still add weapons to the Microtransactions National Store and new hats, and the community's making stuff and Steam Workshop and stuff and so on. But it doesn't feel alive in the way it did when Valve were really focused on it and putting out those class trailers and so forth.
Weirdly, Tiftu, I think it generally does a good job of, you know, updating itself and stuff, but it was a game as a service that had a duration, in that they had 9 classes, and after they decided to make it into a service and have all these extra weapons that they'd add over time, they sort of established this pattern of, we'll do a class update, and this will be the medic update, and then this will be the pyro update and the spy update. And so there was only 9 of those they could ever do. And so they have gone back and like done other ones where they'll come back to just 2 classes, or they'll, you know, they'll theme them still. But for some reason that has never tempted me to go back. It was just the class ones where there was such a huge deal of like going through this game's set of options and giving each one a new life.
They felt canonical in a way that some of the other stuff they've done, like a lot of the updates they do now are community packs, they're community made maps and stuff like that they bundle together in a really clever way, so it's kind of sustainable forever, arguably, if Team Fortress 2 continues to be played by people. But it doesn't feel canonical in the way those updates did, or the ways that these Dota updates do.
Yeah, there's it's like, it's not that people really, really care about the lore. Like, I think Dota's always very cleverly written to be exactly the right length it needs to be for every kind of, to give you a sense that this is has some substance to it, but without being kind of tiresome or overwrought. But, they updated my favorite hero, character called Storm Spirit, because he was one of the heroes with an older model. Like, just, you know, practical. It's always, the thing I like about it, it's always about fixing something practically that's wrong with the game. We need to redesign this hero, or this guy's model was one of the first, in the first generation of the alpha models and kind of needs a refresh. But rather than just sort of do that and roll it out as a patch, admittedly they have sort of done in other contexts, they did it as part of like the Three Spirits update, and In Dota 1, the Warcraft 3 mod, there were three spirit characters, Storm Spirit, Ember Spirit, and Earth Spirit, and the latter two weren't in Dota 2 at all. And Earth Spirit was such a recent hero that no one was expecting him to appear in the game for a long time, because there was a long queue of Dota 1 heroes that were more established, kind of waiting. But Valve just sort of skipped the queue with him to do this kind of update where they revitalized that entire sort of chunk of the game, the sort of elemental spirit characters, and roll them out as one thing, and redesign Storm Spirit, and design the other two so they kind of look like three parts of a whole, and tease it over time, and then launch this thing that feels like, again, I guess you say, like a canonical kind of life of the game event, where the whole thing sort of moves forward a step, and everyone becomes really excited about it again. And like you were saying earlier about like balance in StarCraft, Tom, like the community then suddenly has to react to all of these new things, and you get this amazing flood of videos as people figure out what you can and can't do with the new characters. Like Earth Spirit's been brilliant for that, because his thing is he basically is like a pachinko machine. Like the best thing about Dota is a game. Like if you're talking about this piece of game design, is every hero is so substantially different that you're like playing a different game. Earth Spirit summons little terracotta warriors from the Earth. Versions of himself. All the spirits do this to some variant, like they create a replica of themselves. But his are like solid little physical statues that he can push and pull with sort of like geomagnetic powers. And whether he pushes or pulls them affects the damage, the kinds of damage and status effects they do to people they hit. And it's all those very complicated interactions between, and he can also do that to players. He can kick and push and pull players, including friendlies, to kind of like punt people out of danger. And, you know, the most moment of this is, it sounds kind of dry, and then you're in a battle, and one of your teammates runs up to try and this happened to me, try and get you out of danger, and slams you with his kind of kick ability, and kicks you into a load of bears. And it goes from being like, oh man, this hero is really mechanically interesting. He has both a kind of like a free force staff, but also kind of like a pull thing. That's cool. Into, you kicked me into bears, you asshole. And everyone's like laughing on Skype, and you know, and you want to save it and YouTube it, and the game grows, and the feeling of being part of the game grows and grows, and it stays in people's lives. And that's why it's my game of ever.
Tom,
See ya. Might be Asphlag. Not since I thought I'd ever hear myself say
that. That sounds like the amazing tagline for the game.
Yeah.
Might be Asphlag.
Might be Asphlag.
There are so many games I was looking forward to when the year started. I thought I was really looking forward to Complete Heroes 2. Complete Heroes was one of my favourite games of all time. And it came out and it was fine, it was good. But they'd overcomplicated it. It was too much micro in there, it was too complex and difficult. Then, like, Rome 2 came out, I fucking love Rome 2, but I kind of just don't have the time to devote to it to get something out of it. Like, you have to put hundreds of hours into that to craft a story from it, and it totally has, gives you the tools to craft your own epic storylines across an empire, but you have to invest so much time that it's, you know, just unfeasible. And then I was playing Assassin's Creed for review, and because I was reviewing it, you're just playing it non-stop for ages and ages and ages, and I just didn't get bored or hate it. Well, I kind of accepted its flaws, and you think, okay, it's an Assassin's Creed game, of course it's got a shit intro, of course it's going to be shit for the first 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever. And then suddenly, like, it lets you out onto the ocean, and I could not stop playing it. Like, I just wanted to, when I had to stop and write the review, I just kept wanting to play it rather than writing the review, which is quite unusual, because if you're playing a game for review, you're playing it to such an intense degree that you kind of, it's almost a relief. Like, you've absorbed so much of it in such a short amount of time. But Assassin's Creed 4 was just, I extracted so much joy from it, such a sense of adventure and excitement. Did so much kind of cool and funny stuff in it, just while exploring the world. But even though it's flawed, I think the feeling of adventure and cheer is kind of the humour to being a captain, and every time you get onto that boat, all of your crew just go, "Hey, captain's on board!"
Even if all you did was like pick up a animus fragment from a tree. Yeah,
hey, good job, captain! Yeah, and yeah, just absolutely loved it. From even down to the sea shanties, which should have been the most annoying thing in the game, and possibly they are, unless you collect enough.
Yeah, one of them is.
But you can tell them shut the fuck up, because there's a command for that as well.
Yeah. And sometimes, it doesn't always do this, but sometimes Kenway actually says something when you press the little interface button to stop music. He says, "That's enough now, lads."
Whenever you jump off the ship, captain's going for a swim. Like that. And you're off to kill someone horribly.
It was like, I jumped off my ship onto a jetty, but I missed the jetty and just fell in the water, and they're like, "Captain's overboard!" No, don't tell them!
I just sort of getting into another random fight with the guard and just kicking him so hard that he flies not only off the roof but through the fork in a tree and lands, you know, bounces off a rock. It's kind of flawed and shonky as some of its combat systems are. They're frequently just hilarious. Mm. I've had so much fun with kind of there are these warehouse raids where you have to steal a key from the guy who's guarding the warehouse, and the whole area is guarded. You have to reach the warehouse and then unlock it. At which point, everyone in the area magically disappears, and your men come in and steal everything from the warehouse. But even ignoring that
but then they come back after you've stolen the stuff.
Yeah, so you steal the stuff. There's a cutscene in which all of your men walk into the warehouse and take everything out, and then it puts you back in the game, and all the guards are just still there.
Yeah,
that's really
because
really
the weird. Same way if you board a ship in the middle of a naval combat. So you're fighting two ships, and you cripple one enough that you can get close to it and jump aboard, and you have this awesome fight, and it's really fun to take over.
The other one obligingly waits.
And the other ones don't seem to shoot your ship while you're not on it, which is polite. But then also, after you've conquered the ship and they've surrendered, there's a whole cutscene where you gradually, like, unload all of their cargo and take it back to your ship and start, like after you can repair your ship with bits of theirs, and you can do that in the middle of combat as well, and, like, you see your men, like, testing the cannons and making sure the repairs in order. Like, you're still in a fight. The enemy ship's right there.
There also used to be another cutscene where, like, Kenway gets up and goes, "Ready?" And then the guy's, "Are you sure?" "Yes! Yeah. Resume fire!" And then just get the combat resumes. And
sorry. Yeah. We can unpause now.
Yeah. Continue. Yeah, and there are a lot of kind of dodgy bits, but it's such an ambitious idea for that game. Like, they didn't have to create a whole fucking ocean with an archipelago on it and give you all this stuff to do, and the fact that they've gone for it, and it is frequently so much fun, is delightful.
I got, one of the moments I got really excited about it, I haven't got far enough to know where this goes, but I was doing, like, assassination missions, the sort of non-plot ones where you get it from a pigeon. Pigeon tells you to kill someone, and you kill someone. But all in sort of semi-controlled intro where you're not allowed to go out into the open sea. And then I finally got to the open sea, and I kind of just got caught up in raiding ships and doing all that cool stuff. And then I suddenly thought, oh, I could just, like, there's an assassination mission thing here. I can just take an assassination mission. And my target was, I looked at it on the map, and it's just in the middle of the sea, and realized, oh my god, it's a guy on a ship. I've got to go out and find his ship, and then get on board his ship and kill him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was really, really excited about that. But then actually when I did it, there seemed to be a scripted thing where when I got close enough, he automatically docked at this, like, he was just at near a harbor, and the ship automatically went to the harbor, and he jumped off. And then he had his kind of scripted path up through the cliffs, and there was a particular place he set up for this kill where he went to, and I had to get him there. So are there any assassinations where you actually have to board a ship and kill someone?
Yes.
Yes.
There are. Yeah.
I've done one of those.
Although I did one where the target was sort of in a little British group of assholes. I don't know who the bad guys are, really.
I think you're the bad guy.
Yeah, hang on, that's right, yeah.
The bad there guys. Are lots of nations, as I think Spanish and British. British, yeah. And maybe not French. I think the history guy said there weren't any French people there.
No.
There's like one French character, but he's not. Like,
yeah, no, yeah. No French army.
There are other pirates as well on that sometimes get into fights as well.
Yeah. But the guys, I'm like, in one of those little kind of like, I don't know, stilt village kind of island things. And so I just bombarded it from the shore. Like, obviously the game wanted me, like, there's a radius around it, like, where you can't go without being detected. I have a lot of cannons, and it's 30 feet away. So, and I could see him standing at the edge of the jet, this man in a big hat, like, nothing's wrong with this, and the pirate ship just stops like a car.
And then, assassin, like, incoming.
Yeah. And then I just leveled all of the cannons at the thing, and boom. And then nothing happened. And then I did it again, and it went, target has fled, come back later to try again. Oh. And so in that case, it does kind of cop out of just letting you use the tools at your disposal. It's like, I have a bus full of guns.
Yeah. You failed this mission by using your guns to attack your victim.
Like, admittedly, you know, it wasn't very much the Assassin's Creed.
Well, anything is permitted. Even
yeah, nothing's true.
Nothing's true. Everything is permitted. Please don't use the boat.
Most ironic, like, catchphrase for a game in which the first game was just you being lectured for like 90 minutes on, yeah, that's not so permitted. That's not, you did that in the wrong way. You didn't do it the right way. You're an idiot. We hate you.
The first thing that isn't true is the second part of this sentence.
I quite enjoy that Kenway is so removed from the assassins so long in that game as well, in Assassin's Creed 4.
Yeah.
Like, someone mentions the Assassin's Creed to him, and he's like, everything's permitted. I like the sound of that. As a pirate. Yeah, it kind of...
A pirate? Yeah. Like, it's not one of the game's strongest writing moments.
No, but it's good, because it kind of lets you
do assassiny things without ever tying you to that shit.
Yeah, as far as I played, he's just an assassin cosplayer. he literally just wears the costume and has no obligation.
The costume that he just finds at the start of the game. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah,
I dyed the costume like pretty immediately, and it doesn't even look like an assassin anymore. He's just a guy in like black pirate clothes.
If you hunt enough whales, you can just you get a whaler costume.
Oh, cool!
And a third pistol holster.
Wearing an entire whale.
Yeah, two whales. Actually, a pistol holster not again. I loved it for all its stupidity.
I really want to play more of it.
And I quite like some of the characters in it as well for an Assassin's Creed game. That's good.
Yeah, it's a shame you also work for Google.
Yeah.
God, those bits are awful. They're not as bad as the Desmond bits because they are generally shorter. They're still way too long at times. But there's no challenge to them, at least this time, as far as I play. It's just run here and do this and do that. Whereas in the Desmond sections of the last, I can't even remember which one it was now, not two, but one of the subsequent ones, the Desmond section was just endless and had platforming sections and they were actually like a little bit difficult. It was just, fatal combination of like, fucking hate this character. I hate that you're even taking me into this other world that has nothing to do with what I want to play. And I extra hate that the jumping puzzles in it are shit.
In this one, they've got shit hacking puzzles.
There's
the Frogger one, where that's fucking annoying. There's the weird orb one, where you just kind of...
You have to make an infinitely rotating light
Why?
A magic ball in order to unlock a picture of Desmond.
Yeah.
It's the most disappointing thing anyone's ever done.
How do they not see it? How do they not look at their game and just see it?
I don't know what it is.
But like one day, like whatever their sort of series like, manager is going to look at it and be like, look, all these bits are shit. It's all the modern bits. It's not the assassin-y bits. It's the other bits. The other bits were shit. That's
like,
what it was.
There's a moment where you get pulled out of the Animus and someone's like, well, I know you'd rather be being a pirate. It's like, yes! Yes! Like,
apparently you don't!
There's I'm poaching for myself because I just wrote something for PCG about this, but it feels like they think that they need the modern day bits for the game to mean something. That the rest of it is just sort of like silly, frivolous piracy, you know, historical action, and that in itself isn't enough to give the game like the serious weight and meaning. So it has to have this bizarre high concept, which might have been interesting once, but has been pissed down the drain so many times that it's just completely useless now to them in terms of why anyone plays those games. And you do kind of just want to shake any of the 900 people responsible and just stop it. Please.
Why can't we just have a series like that's just like a horrible histories series but that could just be in history and be a city adventure?
Like Total War. Like, yeah, Total War like, doesn't need a meta level where it explains you're a time-traveling emperor doing different periods of...
God, that would be awful.
Can you imagine if Civ tried to explain who the fuck you are?
God, yeah.
God, it's just like a football manager. Like, you're supposed to be the manager in that, aren't you?
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, probably my game of the year.
Good year for games, though, then? All round?
Weird year.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's been as good as the last 2 years, to be honest. I think I mean, Dishonored last year was fucking extraordinary. Mm. And
Bioshock Infinite.
Which was good. What's that?
Bioshock Infinite.
Oh, I did enjoy
for
it.
For the old AAA things.
The old AAA.
Yeah. I mean,
I did like it. It's weird how much we've all talked about it, how much that game's faded in memory from the initial experience. But I fucking loved it when I played it.
It was really early in the year, wasn't it?
It's like mid-year, wasn't it?
But like by the end of, last year, we were still talking about Mass Effect, which came around roughly the same time of year.
Yeah.
Last
year was Mass Effect 3, wasn't it? And it was Dishonored.
Yeah,
Borderlands 2 was great as well.
And Far Cry 3 was great as well.
Skyrim.
Skyrim's
here
before
that.
Skyrim
was same year as Mass Effect 3.
Nope. Skyrim was November 2011, Mass Effect 3 was March 2012.
Yeah.
Made of Terrorbrero, one of my previous goodies.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Very well.
I believe so.
I think that was an affirmative noise. Affirmative bark.
John Hicks, editor of OXM, writes, "Dear PC Gamer Diaspora, this is a small point, but you've mentioned it a couple of times, so the urge to correct you is overpowering. Chris has said that Watch Dogs is a relation of Assassin's Creed, but I'm reasonably confident it began life as a Chicago-set follow-up to the excellent Driver San Francisco. So this is no longer the case as a cause of profound personal sadness. Please lift my mood by considering sequels, confirmed or otherwise, that would benefit from being reworked into entirely new games. All the best, John T."
In my defence, I made up that thing I said and had no illusion that it was true.
Yeah, I think we just speculated.
We were speculating about...
They might bring them together at some point.
There is a mention of some Watch Dogs thing in Black Flag or something, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. I'm surprised, though. I mean, obviously, Jonty's the person to know, being a game journalist and all. But I'm surprised that its origins lay in a driver game, because I thought the driver games were now the auspices of Reflections, at a time when Reflections still existed and wasn't.
I thought that was just a really fancy turn of phrase. Have come but the auspices of Reflections.
Shadows and Mist.
Do you think they're dead? I don't know.
No, Reflections was the studio who did the excellent Driver San Francisco.
They're still going, aren't they? They've got their Ubisoft Reflections now, but I thought they were still around.
Oh, really? I thought they were in the studios that closed this last year.
Oh, maybe they did. Driver San Francisco was amazing.
Yeah, it was a great game.
It would sort of work within the Watch Dogs fiction of, you know, being able to manipulate that city in that way.
Because you're still in a coma.
Because you're a magic coma ghost.
Oh, you're upgradable coma.
Yeah. Coma ghosts can do anything, right? They can hack telephones.
Yeah, I mean, that's the premise for a lot of indie games.
I think what was happening is they were making their Driver San Francisco sequel, and then they saw Gunpoint, and they're like, oh shit, rewiring's much better, let's do that.
Fuck this coma ghost shit.
You should make a game where you're a coma ghost. In real life buildings, haven't
they? Well, his question is, what sequels, confirmed or otherwise, would benefit from being reworked into entirely new games?
Well, I think Black Flag would probably establish that should have not been an Assassin's Creed game.
Yeah, outside of the Ubisoft kind of...
What about stuff coming out next year? Like, what is happening next year?
So there's... This isn't an answer to this question, really, but an interesting example of a developer handling this is Brendan Chung, where all of his games, even the ones set in space, are in the same fiction, the same universe. So Quadrant Africa was in the same universe as his turn-based space strategy game Flotilla, and the same universe as his, like, spy thrillers and all this other stuff. And I don't know quite how it ties together. I think a lot of it's in, like, Easter eggs and sort of juice mentions on posters and things. Oh, and the zombie apocalypse game, Atom Zombie Smasher, is also the same universe, which is just madness.
I think...
I can't remember a single game that's coming out next year. No.
I'd quite like FIFA 15 to be some sort of mech combat game instead of predictable, iterative football game.
Thief.
Oh, yeah?
The new Thief.
Yeah.
That would be, if that just wasn't...
If it was just... I was about to say something quite cruel.
You made me think of it because you said FIFA. FIFA.
FIFA 2013.
And by a process of word association, which is how... Both game journalism secretly functions. I would like them to not do that and to just call it something else so that it doesn't carry all that baggage.
So Deus Ex 2 would be a good example of a game that should have been its own game, really. Despite, you know, it does have some of the same principles and it's good for some of the same reasons. Whereas Deus Ex 3, I think, actually works better for being part of the Deus Ex universe, because there's actually loads of little geeky thrills you get playing that where you realise, oh, this the character's going to go on to do this later on. And there's loads of cool ways it ties in. And I feel like it is, you know, authentic enough to justify it. Whereas Deus Ex 2, I think, could have avoided a lot of flack and also just made more sense as its own game, because it's way far future sci-fi. It's totally removed from the real world. It's all magic. Unlike grittily realistic Deus Ex.
Actually, everything Bethesda are doing, like Wolfenstein, ought not to really be a Wolfenstein, because it doesn't feel anything like the original Wolfenstein. I think that it does quite a few cool things in terms of destructible terrain and...
Prey 2 as well.
Prey 2 was another one. Yep, there's no reason for that to be associated with a quite dull, linear shooter about solving puzzles and being...
Prey's all right, man. It's not as bad as everything. I mean, it is racist and everything, but, you know, apart from that, you put that aside.
Wolfenstein in New Order should be a Prey game. so it's got the silly laser thing that lets you cut out cover, and it's the kind of thing that would be in a Prey game. There's just weird gimmicks.
Yeah.
It seems to be like what Prey was all about, the weird gravity translators.
Also, Elder Scrolls Online.
Like, oh, God, yeah.
That's a good call.
Well, it's Dark Age of Camelot 3. Like, even if it wasn't, well, to clarify that, where, Warhammer Age of Reckoning, which was closed today, was Dark Age of Camelot 2. Then Elder Scrolls Online is Dark Age of Camelot 3, and it could just have been that series rather than an invariably going to make people angry Elder Scrolls game.
I'm still completely baffled they haven't showed any of the PvP stuff, which is what, you know, Dark Age of Camelot was massively progressive in that area, and they're still doing stuff. Wow, mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, John T.
I used to live with John.
He's lovely. He's very nice.
He is lovely. He likes cars and vans and old exercise. Vans and old cars. Exercise. He does like exercise now.
Quite that buff.
Is weird. Now we're just talking about his
birthday. But, two thumbs up for Jonty.
He's a good assault troop in my XCOM game. The best.
Sam Hayward writes, "Dear Creighton Crowbar, I've been playing Skyrim lately again, on top of other games. I don't play games in long enough spurts to just crunch through each game one at a time. Besides, games like Skyrim and Anno basically never end. So I usually end up trying to get my game time in for a game within the span of an hour or two. I have recently noticed with Skyrim that I tend to always play the game in a way where I try and stop playing that 1 to 2 hour session with me in a town. And then when I go back to it later on, I pretend that the days or hours passed since I last played. It was the amount of time spent resting in the town. This has a nice side effect of making me feel like I'm actually a part of the world without having to make me actually spend my precious playtime smelling flowers in town versus spending that time doing adventures." Skipping ahead. "My question is, what are your guys' thoughts on persistence in the game world when you aren't playing it? Are there any games out there that you have played that you have had actual mechanics put into place that support this? It seems like a tricky thing to design right, because if done wrong, it could be very annoying. But I think it could be a very cool tool in allowing players to let their characters live in a game world to further legitimize it without then having to do all the boring stuff themselves when playing the game. Keep it cool, Sam H." So this is the idea, basically, that you play a game for a couple of hours, you stop. But either the world keeps going or your character keeps going within that world. And there was an MMO that did this recently.
Wushu.
Age of Wushu.
Age of Wushu?
Or I think it has a different name in different territories.
Wushu.
Yeah, and you...
Age of Punching.
You would log out of that game and your character would become an NPC that would continue to walk around the world.
And do your crafting profession.
Yep.
Did they call it a Wushu tar? Like the driver tar in...
Forza, is it?
Car drive six.
Project Cars. Look of Cars. Cars Go.
Yeah, that one.
It's Cars 2013.
We'll get another angry letter from Jonty here, right?
Those games don't exist. what I want is the SimCity game, which does this. And really? Kind of like, if you're going to make your game always online, this is your way to sell it to me. But I really love the idea that my city is constantly alive and developing and evolving and stories are happening there, even when I'm not there. And I love the idea that I could one day have a kind of LCD display on my wall in place of a picture frame that was just a portal onto this living world that was just broiling away that I could stare at when I was bored. That would be great.
I like Neptune's Pride and long games of DEFCON that are always slowly happening, even if you're not looking at them or though you might go away. There's still activity happening on the board. Neptune's Pride in particular, which is a multiplayer space strategy game, but happens very, very slowly in real time. So you're sending ships from planet to planet, but they will take 8 hours to reach their destination, and or 12 hours depending on how far away and how good your warp drives are. But we would people would get up at 5 a.m. in the morning and launch attacks then, because or like launch attacks at 4 a.m. or 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. whenever they thought other people wouldn't be awake, so that they would wake up later and then see that a certain amount of movement had happened.
Watching their MSN logo for the point where it goes grey to say that they've gone offline.
That's it. He's gone to bed. That's right. And then by the time they've woken up and realised, it's far too late.
We can mention that Ron Carmel of World of Goo fame has recently announced that he's working on a new game called Subterfuge, which is a week-long game of deception and lies. And that's all it says about it, but it sounds like it's kind of Neptune's Pride with spies, basically.
Neptune's spies.
Neptune's spies, you might say.
Spies Pride.
There's a...
No.
Nespies, spies. I'm not super excited about it because Neptune's Pride, I think, is a really well-made game, but I'm never going to play it again. I don't want to play anything about betraying my friends on a long-term basis because it just wounds too deep. It's just too serious. I can't take the stakes.
I mean, the other side of this guy's question is the kind of role-player imaginative putting this into games for yourself. And I totally, not to surprise no one, but I totally do exactly the same thing. I always appreciate it when games give you the facility to set up that thing for yourself, even if other players don't want to.
World of Warcraft gives you a rest bonus if you're in a tabin when you're logged out.
So it certainly kind of implies what your character's been doing while you're logged out is just being in the pub. Mm-hmm. Like every save game I've had in Mass Effect, for example, is in Shepard's cabin. Because then it doesn't really matter if I take a break for a day or so. I mean, I'm not imagining that time is passing for my character as it is for me. But it feels like a natural break, right? Like there's been a lull of some time in this action from, I mean, yeah, I guess you could measure your days from bed to bed, right? Like from when you get up to when you go to sleep. And
this is exactly how I played Dishonored. And I was reminded of it when you said, spent your time in the pub. Like you literally go back to the pub and then go back and go to bed. And I would close the game down and open it up the next day and keep playing from there and do another mission.
Well, this is the thing, like actually having a strong sense of, some games tend to do very well in the name of convenience, is giving you a strong sense of how much time has passed. Like Skyrim is a kind of interesting example of this, that how long it takes you to run somewhere versus how long it takes you to fast travel somewhere is approximately equal, but none of it feels kind of proportionate to the size of the country you're in relative to the amount of days that are passing. So that, like, after hundreds of hours of that game, having done crazy, you know, fought gods and done all this stuff and gone from being nobody to being the most powerful person ever, like 3.5 weeks had passed pretty much for everyone else. And like, you can imagine if that happened in real life, but there's just one guy just pelting through the landscape, like doing it, solving every problem in the world, like at a clip. Whereas Mass Effect is an interesting example actually, because in the first game, it was strongly suggested, although kind of vaguely at the time, that, that the whole first game takes place over the course of about 4 months. That's the time, as the characters have experienced it, even though it's really just four principal missions. Between that, like, because space travel takes a substantial amount of time. And the story is designed to be paced around the idea that there's a lot of time kicking around the ship getting to know each other, and the story progresses based on that. And I'd love to see the Mass Effect game, say, or whatever, that sort of doubled down a little bit more on giving you that sense of the amount of time that is passing for the characters, even if it isn't passing for you. Like, and all the Mass Effect games have done that, but they work at such an accelerated pace in order to keep throwing you into a new exciting thing.
What do you mean
thing.
You boot up a save game and it gives you like a synopsis of what's happened while you've been
away? I'm not sure exactly how it'd be, to be honest, it could actually be achieved more through kind of little detail in the story. Like there's
GTA 5, when you load up, your character's just in the middle of doing something.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
In a shop or something, or just somewhere you didn't leave them. They've clearly been doing stuff while
naked, surrounded by other naked men in one case as well, which is slightly alarming.
There's,
dead naked men.
I think basically the key to it is just giving the player enough detail for them to fill in the rest. You don't need an itinerary of what everyone's been doing. You need enough detail to know that there's a life in this that you're not quite seeing, but gives you a sense that it exists without you, even if it doesn't literally keep running in the background or whatever. Like, there's a great line of dialogue in Mass Effect 2. One thing I would draw out is, one of the companies you know, Thane, who's this sort of solitary assassin, and being on your crew is the first time he's ever not worked alone. He has a line where he says that the weirdest thing for him is actually meals, that he's never not eaten on his own before, and he has no idea how to sit at a dinner table. And it's just a really nicely observed bit of character, right? That, like, that's what's weird. You never have those meals as a cutscene. They don't exist in the game. But having that one detail gives you everything you need to know. But actually, so between missions, we have meals together. Like, all the characters, some of the characters will be at the mess table that you can walk past. Like, that for me makes the entire world feels like it has a life beyond me in a way that I find incredibly gratifying. And every game should have that, in my opinion. Every game for which it's correct to have that.
Not just every game.
No, every game. Every game, yeah. I want to find out what the Dota heroes do when they're not playing.
When the cards get up to in Hearthstone.
Yeah.
Shuffle themselves around in your deck.
I'll say.
Charlie Roney writes in to ask, "Dear Crunks and Cro-Magnons, I was wondering about your thoughts on the tactical shooter genre of games, from its birth and height with Rainbow Six and Counter-Strike to its fade in recent years to more action and character progression-based modern shooter counterparts. What do you think the future holds for the more methodical, dare I say, pure tactical shooter? Keep up the great work, Yuri. Charlie."
Yeah, I want to lament the lack of a recent Rainbow Six game. Or a SWAT game or something like that. They were fantastic in co-op. Like, that methodical nature encouraged a form of teamwork that was deeply satisfying in a shooter context. It could be both tense and quiet, and then suddenly very loud and angry and explosive in the way that a shooter could be. And I really, really miss that.
Early Clancy games were all about that. Were about kind of mimicking those kind of correct tactics without the entire weight of simulation that the Bohemia Interactive games bring, which is also kind of like a millstone around their neck to some extent, because it makes them very vulnerable to bugs and kind of pedantic in their detail. Whereas the Clancy games really struck a good balance, initially anyway.
They did a great job of getting that kind of emotional simulation of like the tension and vulnerability of going into a museum, say, or anywhere else. And even as recently as Rainbow Six Vegas 2, you had kind of terrorist hunt mode that managed to create those situations where you and a friend would cooperatively try and take out terrorists that could come at you from any angle and were extremely deadly. If they shot you first, then that was it. You were just fucked. And I do really miss that stuff. And there was, what was it? Takedown Red Saber?
Yeah.
Was the Kickstarter attempt to bring back...
Put back Red Saber.
Was the Kickstarter attempt to kind of, you know, it was, I think it was Hardcore Tactical Shooter or something was its project name on Kickstarter. And it was just a shit fest. It was just like, I don't think that's libelous. I think being able to say it's a shit fest is fine. It had lots of bugs and, server tech didn't work and it had lag and the AI was awful and the animation was rubbish and it had very few maps and the community just kind of was stillborn. People were still turned off by the first version they put out, but I don't think it's really gone anywhere. And it's a real shame. And there was stories just this past week of Ubisoft talking about Rainbow Six Patriots.
Rebuilding it.
Yeah, it was the abysmal looking Rainbow Six game that they pitched in 2011.
Oh yeah, I remember
press
that.
That's to wife.
That offensive CGI trailer that they made.
And just morally bankrupt, horrible. I got so angry about that, but there is a thing where you just kill a civilian, you throw him off a bridge for shock value, and also justice in the American way. But they retooled that, and they're still working on it, and they say that, you know, it might never come out if they don't ever get it right, and it might not be called Patriots anymore, and it might not be about terrorism anymore, and who knows. So they, you know.
But it's not going to be a tactical first-person shooter of the Clancy games of yore. It's going to be a bombastic COD-alike, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what was quite impressive? Because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, because they will do some story-driven shit, and as soon as it's story-driven, it has to be scripted, and as soon as it's scripted, it's not properly tactical, and then, you know, that all falls apart. I actually think Rainbow Six Vegas 2, I think, both of them were, decent single-player campaigns in terms of the actual mechanics. Playing the levels was fun. They used the actual tactical tools that you had available to you in multiplayer and in co-op, and it didn't sort of violate them too much, except in when you fight the final boss and suddenly your guns or you're not allowed to shoot at him while the dialogue is going on and that kind of stuff. But until that point, it was just the story kind of kept out of the way of the action. It was like, here's the context for this mission, now it's a building full of guys, kill all the guys, get to the objective, and then a bit more story and then get back to the actual game. And it was actually pretty good at keeping those two things separate.
I wonder if the modern version of these games is things like DayZ, where, you know, you can work together with other players and you're very vulnerable and you can kind of, you scope out an area before you move into it to check how many zombies are there and making predictions about what's inside and then move in as a group and so forth. Related to that, Tom Clancy's The Division, which is clearly DayZ inspired and has kind of designed for those sort of, the word mingle player is the one who is hideous up there with phablet
to drink.
it's kind of set in a semi-open world, semi-online, semi-MMO, with you and four friends roving through these environments, scavenging for goods, moving into buildings and encountering both AI enemies and multiplayer other people enemies.
Maybe
other people enemies. Semi.
Splinter Cell co-op, and things like even in Conviction, which is quite a fun co-op campaign, are similar, perhaps more modern than most modern iterations on the old tactical shooter, infiltration genre.
There's nothing with a map phase though, is there?
No, sadly not.
Yeah, map phases have gone away.
They went away quite quickly though, didn't they, after the Rainbow Six 1 had that use to draw the pathfinding for your fellow scouts. Yeah.
And you could set go points, and so you have go point Alpha and go point Bravo and go point Charlie.
Yeah.
And then when you're in the game, so you'd have everyone go to the different door of the building and then set go point Alpha for all of them at that door, and then go point Bravo would be indoors somewhere, wherever you want them to get to. And so the game would start, and they'd all run to the doors, and then they'd just wait, and then you'd go in by your method and, you know, snipe a couple of terrorists, and then if anyone came to, like, chase you down, you go, "Bravo, go!" And everyone breaches all these doors all over the house and comes rushing in and shotgunning people down. So cool.
It's worth remembering that about 20% of your squad would get stuck in the doorway when you initiated this. It didn't entirely work, but I fucking love the idea of it. I also love that shotguns went through doors in that game, and part of breaching was just like shooting a few shotgun blasts through a door before entering. That felt fucking amazing.
There's a game to be made which combines Rainbow Six and Frozen Synapse.
Because
Frozen Synapse is basically the map phase from Rainbow Six, but it works the game. where, you know, and you add that to maybe an FPS element where you're actually one of those characters yourself and responsible for executing those moves to an extent yourself with a bit of creative freedom.
This is that kind of like, you know, you get Orcs Must Die, which is like a tower defense game, but it's got that third person component to it where you're running around doing stuff. Or is it Sanctum, the Sanctum game?
Yeah.
First person equivalent. So yeah, you just want the Frozen Synapse, which is, has the first person character you can embody within that.
Mm.
And you've got Rainbow Six.
Make it, somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody.
Casey Clare writes, "Hey there, crating crow bargaining bare-handed barnacles." Okay. "In my private high school in California, we write a 30-page thesis senior year about a controversial topic which we care about and are invested in. The obvious topic choice for me was to defend a belief which I hold incredibly strongly in my heart, but haven't articulated in a logical, meaningful way."
Yet.
"Every time I ever had a chance to defend myself in the case, it has been to some elder or authority figure, whether it be my parents, grandparents, or teachers, and always after having my choice of pastime insulted in the most derisive of manners. So I decided I would not go for the impassioned verge of tears outburst of emotion in my thesis. Instead, I want to provide a logical point of view on why video games are not a waste of time, but something that is important and useful. The real problem is research. I can't seem to find anyone who argues with logic. Conversations on the internet about gaming being a waste of time usually go something like this. Quote, video games are a waste of time and money. You'd do better to spend your time outside being social, etc. End quote. And then the person responds, you mad, OP? As my heroes in the game...
Say to them.
Yeah, we should have role-played this. As my heroes in the games industry, not only some of the most intelligent, but some of the most... Well, this is the reason you mark this to be right now, isn't it? Not only some of the most intelligent...
And also very flattering.
Not only some of the most intelligent, but some of the most well-informed on the subject. I immediately wondered what you guys would say on the subject. Phew, glad I finally summoned up the courage to send this email. Casey Clare. P.S. I know I'm long-winded. You don't have to read the whole thing out on the podcast if you don't want. Well, that part of your email was on a separate page from the rest.
Too late. Should have come sooner.
I think the question of whether or not your hobby is actually providing you of anything of value or of lasting value is a really interesting one. And it's something that seems to be particularly pointed at the moment in the age we live in at people who play games. Like, I've certainly... not only experienced it, but also leveled it up myself. Like, am I just wasting vast amounts of my time and energy on Graham's nodding emphatically?
Really, like,
on something that...
Not in I know what you mean way, but in a yes, you are way.
Yeah. Are you referring to a particular game, Graham?
No, actually, I think that particular game, that does have great value.
Thanks. but what I'm saying is, like, it's interesting that, I mean, I guess I managed to make almost something you might call a career if you squint out of the fact that I play a lot of video games, which is very lucky, but obviously most people don't have that literally, this is what I get out of my hobby type arrangement with it.
Mm.
And other hobbies people might pursue are equally vapid in some ways, and other hobbies are less so. But I think there are things specific to games. I think we talked about this before in the case of games being especially good at maybe changing behaviours or imparting information or giving you a breadth of experience that do make what you get to do by being enthusiastic about games meaningful and valuable to you, not simply in the fact that you're entertained by them, but in that they are somehow good for the flexibility of your brain or the breadth of your thinking, even if that thinking is, I do love pirates.
I don't think this stuff needs to be particularly high-minded even. Like, I agree that, that games can broaden your thinking, and there are studies out there, if you're looking for logical defenses of this stuff, that they help with brain plasticity and stuff like that. But I think there is value in non-destructive distractions. I think all of us...
they said drinking.
Well, in moderation. I think, everyone needs a way to de-stress, to unwind, to take their mind off the things which are more important in their lives. And I think video games or television or any form of pop culture can be a good way of doing that. And I think there are games certainly which are destructive in the way that they're structured and the way that they incentivize purely the behavior of playing them for the sake of playing them, for the sake of doing it forever, for the sake of giving all your money to this thing, certain free-to-play style mechanics and that kind of thing, which can be damaging. But if a game is giving you a sense of progress, is giving you some form of satisfaction, is distracting you, is entertaining you, is not and aiming to enslave you to those kind of mechanics, then that's fine, and it doesn't need to necessarily be a high work of literature to do that. It's totally fine to just binge watch Fringe on Netflix. It's totally fine to just play Football Manager till 2:30 in the morning like I did yesterday.
Most people aren't happy. a lot of gamers are happy, not all of them, but like a lot of us who are really into this hobby and who get really excited about the next game they're looking forward to and then play that game and really, really enjoy it and get genuine, not just pleasure, but kind of, oh my god, this is so fucking cool. There aren't that many equivalents to that you can have on a reliable basis throughout your life. Even TV can be great, at its very peak, TV gets that good. But I think for a lot of gamers, we're just playing great stuff all the time. And just basically all having an amazing time constantly by playing games. And the happiness is, happiness is obviously the entire point of life. But also has a secondary benefit of also is good for your health and, keeps you, people who are happy just live longer and are less susceptible to diseases. But that's not to say playing games for a long period of time is necessarily healthy. I think it's one of the reasons that the addiction debate is important, because it is probably all of us have had some game that we played to the point where we kind of aren't really enjoying it anymore. But games can be both really effective at creating pleasure and also really effective at making you not notice they're not creating you pleasure.
I read a really interesting essay, which is not about games at all, but I might put a link in the show notes, which is about the idea of polymathics, which is the notion that so the guy is discussing the idea of the polymath, like the person who is an expert in a lot of different subjects. And in human culture, we traditionally think of those people as like Leonardo da Vinci's. Like polymath kind of come to mean genius, which it doesn't really mean. It simply means someone who knows a lot of different things as opposed to one thing. And there's an interesting argument that says that, I'll dial it back to games, don't worry, says that society, the structure of society and what people are encouraged to do with their lives is incredibly, monomathic, right? The idea is that you specialize in one thing. Like when you write a CV to get a job, you don't really emphasize your breadth of experience. You try and engineer yourself into looking like the type of person who's only ever wanted to do this one thing that you're now applying for. Because culture, our society value specialty and expertness over breadth. But there are studies that suggest that that plasticity of the brain that Graham was talking about, the idea that you're still capable of receiving new challenges, which some games are really good at doing, is keeping your brain responding to new kinds of experiences and new things, is incredibly healthy. That is the health component of playing games. In the context of the essay I'm talking about, it's more about continuing to learn different things as you get older, continuing to pick up a music instrument when you're 30, learn to cook at a different age, just keep doing different things, get a second degree in whatever, or third degree or fourth degree or whatever, and just keep learning things. But I think that applies to, on a smaller scale, to keep playing different things and sort of expanding the types of challenge your brain is used to. And it has apparently physiological differences to the parts of your brain that see use. There's theories that it's due to almost a single-minded focus is what leads to things like the atrophy of the memory, basically. Your brain stops recording experiences at the moment when it stops having new ones.
If you're forced to apprehend and then learn new systems to interact with,
yeah,
then you're going to get better at that task.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Has lots of kind of real-world applications.
But the principles of atrophy and everything else still apply because your brain is also a muscle of the kind, and that can help later life with, you know, remaining psychologically healthy and compos mentis into old age, for example. Like, it'd be interesting, fast forward 40 years, 50 years, when the generation's had games their entire lives, like whether we have fewer instances of things like Alzheimer's, for example, because, you know, presumably we're going to play games our entire lives and we'll become old people who are yelling at nubs and Dota in the old people's home, and whether or not that will, you know, help. I'm speculating completely, but it'd be interesting to see if that's
the arthritis is going to be worse and more of a problem for us.
But we'll be controlling games with our brains by then, so it'll matter.
We'll have Kinect.
I don't think you need to apologise for your entertainment. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of entertainment.
You might do.
You live in a graveyard.
But, you know, there are lots of forms of entertainment which are equally or less beneficial to you than various games are. Like binge-watching Fringe. Completely pointless. I don't know why I did that.
Do a Fringe binge.
Yeah.
Don't do a Fringe binge, kids.
Don't do a Fringe binge.
I've also done a Fringe binge, and I encouraged you in your Fringe binge, and I would encourage others in
your
Fringe binge.
You're a Fringe binge enabler.
Yeah. Fringe binge cheerleader.
Fun to say.
Thomas Westergaard asks, hi, cardboard cubes and carbon iron cross pieces. With Christmas around the corner and a minimum number of exams and a rather large amount of Christmas, New Year, pagan solstices parties in the near future, can you recommend some games that can be played with a hangover? Thanks for podcasting, everybody. Regards, Thomas.
Proteus.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
That's very bright.
Very bright, yeah. We can turn the brightness down.
It's kind of soothing.
It's like, because there's no objective, well, there's kind of objective, but there's no pressure, and you just wander around and do whatever you like, and you can kind of take it at your own pace, and you can kind of just walk towards it, whatever's intriguing you at the moment, and kind of just listen to that. And if it, like, makes a sound you don't like, you just walk away from it. Just walk away and make a different experience happen. And so, like, the whole nature and mood of the experience is kind of up to you.
I play turn-based games in those situations for the simple reason that you can control the pace of it. So if I need to just sit and close my eyes for a moment or stare at the ground and rub my temples.
Talking about a serious level of hangover.
Yeah.
I think you almost measure hangovers by what kind of game you play. Like, real bad hangover for me is in bed with Pokemon. Hang on. That came out.
What did I do last night?
But yeah, no, turn-based things. MMOs, I really like. I always have like MMOs for these kinds of things because you can, you know, you're not, you know, min-maxing at that point. You're not out to beat the toughest raid or get the most out of a given leveling session. But if you just kind of, like Guild Wars would be a nice example of this, just sort of wander a nice place and press the buttons and watch the monsters fall down.
I don't want to see the other people though. I don't want other people to see me when I'm hungover.
Don't look at me! Yeah, no, there's a gently social aspect to it as well. Just, you know, you see the people around, you're not alone. Not alone, but you can be alone if you like.
I recommend Kentucky Route Zero, which is a beautiful episodic adventure game series. I think maybe the kind of deep sickness, like on an existential level that you feel with extreme hangovers, is well reflected in the warped and dark world of Kentucky Route Zero. And maybe in that reflection you might take some solace, briefly at least.
Aaron Probetz asks, dear mate and Tobar, back in the late 90s I spent a significant amount of time trying to convince my friends to read this fantasy book that I loved called A Game of Thrones. I would explain how well written it was, describe in rough terms the themes and initial plot, big up the unceremoniously killing of major characters, and then quietly throw in that it contains dragons. My friends weren't fantasy readers. I would always urge them to try the book, and if they agreed, would add that they had to read at least 100 pages before giving up, as it is only then that they can be invested in the characters and story, have a knowledge of the plot, and know which of the characters contained within 30-something pages of the appendix they should remember and which they could forget. I hear quite frequently on your podcast of you bouncing off games, or certain genres of games, and I started wondering whether there is a minimum amount of time that should be given before giving up on it. Does it depend on the genre of game? Should platformers have to grab you within minutes to keep your attention, while an RPG should be allowed several hours of play to fully hook you in? Also in reference to this, are there any games you now consider to be great that you initially bounced off? For me, Deus Ex Human Revolution was difficult to get into until I had some praxis points to spend and upgrade, as I had not played the original but had heard amazing things about it and the aforementioned sequel from one Tom Francis, and was expecting to be able to play it in a certain way that my lack of skill did not allow. A few praxis points in, and my ability started to enhance my skill, and I grew to love the games. Keep up the Crate podcast.
Did you say the Crate podcast?
Yeah,
he did. Very good. Very good. Good work.
I definitely find that my number of hours I'm willing to invest in something without it grabbing me has gone down over the years to the point where it's about 34 seconds now. It's like, if it's not good in 34 seconds, fuck it forever! And in fact, I recently gave up on Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon within... It felt like about 17 hours, but I think it's probably less than 5 minutes because the tutorial was so bad and so arduous and irritating. And I knew it was irritating and it was kind of rubbing its irritatingness in your face as a joke, but then also just going on to be incredibly, incredibly irritating.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I can't do it. I can't go any further with this. I'm too annoyed. Like, I got past a bit that was really, really prescriptive, and then in the next bit, which was a little bit more open and I had to take out some enemies, I was just, like, not even playing properly, just sprinting through things and just, like, pressing fire randomly, and I realized I'm just too angry with this game to actually play it now. It's ruined itself for me. And I definitely think that it's something that's changed, like, over the years. I used to be really willing. I used to get like 3 games a year. So I would fucking get everything out of the game. I would play it to the point where I, you know, could not get any further. Even if it wasn't good, just keep on playing. And now that there's thousands of games and, we're completely spoiled for choice, they have to grab me much, much quicker. And I definitely think about it loads as a designer. Even with Gunpoint, which went through a lot of iteration to kind of get you into the good stuff as quickly as possible. I've shown it at a lot of shows, and I've done that mostly after it was finished or after it was pretty much done. And you start to realize, why the hell is the crosslink on, like, level 3? The crosslink should be level 1, because that's the thing that's actually good about the game. Why are there these two levels of things that aren't good about the game, or things that are kind of like, okay, but not really the point? Because as soon as you see someone quit the game before the main point of it, you realize, fuck! Everything else I did is wasted on that person. They'll never find out what was good about this game. And okay, in like a trade show environment or a convention environment, people are a lot less patient and they kind of give up a lot sooner. But I also think just a lot of people at home are like that, particularly with demos and, you know, if you're lucky enough to get their time and attention for them to play your first level, it better be fucking good. They better really want to play the next level after that.
I think it's a thing of, there are lots of different ways to keep my attention, and so an RPG, I don't know if I would necessarily give it more time than a platformer if I wasn't enjoying it right off the bat, but an RPG has thousands of different ways that it can grip my attention. All it has to have is a character say something which I think is funny or I think makes me intrigued by that character or be set in an interesting world and that I'm going to invest more time in it than I would have otherwise.
Whereas a platformer, whose main joy is platforming, you'll know whether that's good or not when you first jump.
Yes.
So,
although, I mean, I thought this was interesting.
Mitigating things. Sorry.
Spelunky. Again, we spoke about on this same podcast about being a platformer that many, you know, smart people have taken quite a while to really crack why it's good. You know, and like that's, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, for these games. And, I think, actually, I was thinking about this because I can get bored quite quickly with certain types of games, like something like a grand strategy, a genre I've never really been into. If confronted with the vast, baffling interface, I will very quickly go, oh, fuck no. But I can be really pig-headed about doing things I don't even enjoy if there's something I want in the game somewhere, like some fantasy I'm chasing. Like, I really, 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 really want to be a space captain. So if it's in there somewhere in this game, it doesn't matter how obtuse the game systems are, or how naff its tutorial is, or how long it takes to get to the good stuff, I will just keep playing it and playing it and playing it. So that suggests that it's less about genre in terms of which games require more time to unpack and which don't. It's more about can you really simply encapsulate that little fantasy or whatever it is that the player will chase to get them further into the game? Like, Spelunky doesn't really have that because it's fantasy. You know, the kind of thing that's beautiful about it is quite highfalutin. You know what I mean? It's the kind of the promise of infinite different adventures forever. And if your first couple of adventures are short and a bit unsatisfying and hard and kind of thing. You don't care that it's beautifully randomly generated in an incredibly smart way or that its systems are particularly deep. Your first two experiences have been shit. And by the same logic we've talked about, you say, fuck this forever and never play it again. But that requires perseverance that goes way beyond its genre and goes into appreciation of what it's trying to do and what it achieves and everything else.
I'm going to try and play Baldur's Gate 2 over the Christmas break, which has a famously dreadful opening dungeon, which lasts about 5 hours. And oh god, I tried to play it before and it was fucking awful. But there's a mod that lets you skip it. So I'm going to play Baldur's Gate 2 for the first time with this mod, and it just basically dumps you in the sunlight. With a brief kind of one paragraph description of what happens in the dungeon, which is what you need. There is no plot development in the dungeon apart from, you know, the things you fight. And then I'm just going to try and play it from there on and see if that has solved my entire problem with that game. It's a game I deeply want to play for hundreds of hours. So that goes.
Anna asks, "Dear Krem and Crodies, does ludonarrative dissonance exist?" Thanks for podcasting, Anna.
Begrudgingly, yes.
Yeah.
Gene Mackey asks, "Dear Crabs and Crybabies."
Aw.
Fuck you. I recently finished Far Cry 3. I certainly enjoyed it, particularly its organic feeling stealth system, but my overall impression was that I saw pretty much everything the game had to offer, mechanically, in the first hour and a half. And the rest was just that again with slightly different terrain. Then I popped onto PC Gamer to read Tom French's excellent review of Backpacks and saw he'd given the game 89%. I was staggered. As you've often said that at PC Gamer you use the entire review scale. Score inflation is a large part of modern games journalism, and Tevis Thompson recently wrote an excellent essay on the subject, reminding us how crazy it is that a 9 out of 10 review can actually bring down the average rating of a huge number of games which, when played with an analytical eye, are pleasant but nothing special. The Arkham games, Gears of War, GTA 5, etc. Obviously all ratings should be, in theory, entirely the subjective opinion of the individual reviewer. But when sites and publications appear to start their review scores at 75%, just for a game that is merely technically competent, you worry about the surrounding culture. Why can't we have the entirety of the review scale used? Why can't we analyse to a greater degree? Why do so many of the reviews I read merely play out like updated previews? I don't mean to insult PC Gamer.
Too late, sir.
Yep, too late.
I actually love your reviews and find your analyses very intelligent, but even you seem to be affected by score inflation. Cheers, Gene Mackey.
I think what Gene has done there is assume that he and I have the same opinion of Far Cry 3, and that I have then added the extra 30% to inflate the score to the standard deviation that we need for games journalism. Whereas in fact what happened was we had different opinions of Far Cry 3, and I gave it the score that I believed it deserves. I mean, Far Cry 3 was amazing. It was one of the best games of 2012?
Last year.
The year it came in, out in. And I think it was one of the best stealth games ever. I think taking down an outpost in Far Cry 3 is one of those perfectly tuned confluences of mechanics and all of the kind of things that stealth games struggle with each time they come out and usually get wrong to some extent or another. Far Cry 3 is the one game I feel like gets all of them right. Like, you know, management of intel and using sound and distraction and satisfying takedowns and difficulty and alarm systems. It's all just perfect. And my biggest criticism in my review was that it wasn't the same again and again. I kind of wanted it to be. Like, taking down the outpost is fucking fantastic, and I'll do that for 25 hours. But unfortunately, there's like a single-player campaign tacked onto it that's really has some really frustrating scripted missions. And in the end, my feeling was that like the open-world stuff is so good that the fact that there is also the single-player thing that is annoying doesn't negate that. Like, you do have to play it to a certain extent to get certain abilities to make the rest of the game better. But once you've got those, you can ignore it. And then the fact that it's kind of shit in many places doesn't affect the fact that there's an awesome game in there. And I think what often one of the reasons that people who reviewed a game end up giving it a higher score than people who played it and bounced off it feel it deserves is that when you review something, you have to sit down and find out what's good about it. You have to actually explore all of it and see if there is virtue to be found. And if there is, then you find it. And so you like it. And because games are interactive, you get to say, hey, like, in the case of Far Cry 3, the open world stuff is fucking awesome, and taking down these outposts is just brilliant. And there is this scripted campaign that's not as good, but you don't have to play it, so it's good. Whereas in a movie, if there's, like, first 2 hours of shit and the last hour is good, the 2 hours have to count against it. They have to be, they can only be as good as the fraction of it that's good. Whereas game, you actually get to choose which bit you play, so. Yeah.
I got feelings about this question. there's a bunch of different sides to this. The issue actually at its core is that games journalism has a problem with transparency in its methods. You explaining that that's the criteria you looked for in a game helps to elucidate the reason why the score differs from Gene's expectation of the score of Far Cry, right? Like that's, you know, a kind of, but that we can't frame every review within a kind of coddling blanket of context that explains that it's one person's opinion. And it is unfortunately the nature of opinion on the internet to be taken as somehow kind of monolithic and there to be chipped away by the valiant warriors of the counter-argument. The issue is I guess transparency of process, and articles like that Trevor Thompson essay are popular, I suspect, because they come across as in some way revealing or, you know, like exposing of the secret problem. And the secret problem is this kind of, artificial inflation thing, which actually, to be honest, is a way more interesting issue when you pick it apart than some kind of bizarre industry cowardice, which is what we're often accused of. What it actually is, I think, is that games used to be basically shit most of the time and probably broken in almost every case. The idea that you buy a PC game and it just wouldn't fucking work was basically normal. So if you bought a game and it worked at all, that's probably 50%, right? Because 50% of games did not function. And therefore, therefore the scale kind of ended up skewed from the beginning. Towards sort of starting a little higher. And that maybe is legitimately a good point, that maybe that's something where nowadays games are just expected to work, really. Not working at all is zero, everything else is somewhere above that. That's a legitimate point. Exactly the same problem exists in tech reviews, where everything sort of exists in a higher scale because
everything basically works now.
Yeah, everything basically works now, but that wasn't always the case, and that sort of shunted the kind of culture of scoring relative to other scores. It's not a question of some sort of artificial inflation bias. It's about giving games a score that feel representative of their value and whatever value they do actually possess, in the moment of their first release, relative to the general expectation of what scores are and what they mean to the people who'll be receiving them and attempting to use them to make a consumer advice decision. This will be the review where we reset the score and give Far Cry 65 for being two-thirds brilliant, exactly, in some sort of bizarre mathematical way, you will confuse and alienate far more people than you assist. So change won't necessarily be slow and moderate and over time and reasoned in each case, rather than kind of reacting to some kind of broad rhetorical enemy.
It's gross that so many essays have been written about fucking numbers at the end of reviews. Like, it's not, like, okay, there's a scale that exists to broadly categorise games, but what's actually happening is the 2,000 words that preceded that number. And that's what should be talked about. It should be about the methods of criticism, you know, the points that are picked out. Those are the things that should be turned over, not fucking score inflation is completely fake. Nonsense concepts. Like, that's not actually, you're talking about nothing. talking about games anymore. You're just talking about a weird,
The interesting thing is that, like, scores now obviously have this weird extra element where publishers will set targets based on Metacritic and things like that. Obviously, no critic should ever consider that in terms of the kind of scores they give. But it does highlight that scores don't exist in isolation anymore, and that there is a kind of, like, what the numbers technically mean in relation to a scale of 100, and what they mean emotionally to people, or what they mean, like, in the culture that they involve in, are a different scale.
It's subjectively interpreted by everyone who looks at the score interprets that number.
This is what I'm saying. Like, ultimately, the idea of inflation doesn't really apply when not only is the review that precedes it subjective and based on the opinion of the reviewer, but the number itself is based on a kind of subjective reinterpretation of the scale from 1 to 100 by a lot of people that's actually fairly broadly agreed on.
It's the problem of video game reviews being presumed, or their scores being presumed, to be homogenous in some way, when actually an Edge 9 is radically different from the 9 that Polygon would give, or the 9 that an OPM would give. And it's to do with a lot of it, the way these video game websites and magazines have delineated themselves along platform lines, and as the platforms, the 360s and the PlayStations and so forth, have become more homogenous and released basically the same game and espouse more or less the same philosophies, people presume that the outlets do the same, and the outlets kind of do, which is a problem that you don't have in other mediums. Like, there is an idea of what is an NME band versus what is a Q band, and when the NME kick the shit out of a band that they hate is because that band fails to espouse the values that NME want to encourage and promote. It's not necessarily that they're arguing that that music is objectively bad and everyone should hate it. It's that they're saying, if you like NME style music, the music that we like, the things that we shout about and put on our cover, then you'll hate this. And there are video game magazines and video game websites that do the same thing, and there is a distinction between IGN and Edge, even though they use the same numbers.
That's why they have words next to them.
And that's why they have words next to them, and that's why Metacritic is such a problem, because it tries to take all those different numbers, and yes, it applies weighting in that it will treat Edge more seriously on the scale than it will a random blog that happens to also score things. But also it tries to put everything together in the same pot and mix it together, which you can't actually do because they don't mean the same thing. And if you take these scores within context, and then the other thing you should do is lighten the fuck up. Because partly I think that scores are there to be a kind of fun shorthand for discussion, and people, I don't mind that people discuss the scores. I meant that they consider it to be the most important part. And I don't necessarily think that they should, you know, read the words and have a, you know, more informed debate. But if they're going to debate the scores, then they shouldn't be quite angry.
The score itself is not an object. It's not a measurement. You know what I mean? It's not a, it's not a, this game is 93 tall, right? You know what I mean? It, what that, the score is a way of, it's an act of communication, right? It's just a numerical one, right? You transmit a message with the score you choose to give that is designed to prompt the response you're looking for. So, like, I remember re-reviewing Dota for PC Gamer and going back and forth, I remember talking to you at the time about this, Graham, going back and forth on whether or not I was going to give it a 90, because I wanted to, because it's my favorite game ever, and, you know, but at the same time, like, I know a lot of people hate it, and whatever, and it's like, no, I feel like if there's enough there that I can pull the trigger on a 9, and if anyone wants to fight me, I feel like I'm ready to fight them. You know what I mean? Like, I'm confident in... Like, that felt like the kind of, like, fire, like, loudly proclaiming my enthusiasm for the game and my belief in it, as opposed to kind of, like, topping out with a safer score that would attract less attention. And that's because the score is not, and it's not that I'd literally taken a measure of the game and gone, no, it is 5 better than another game. It's because I had gone, actually, I want to make a statement with this, and this is how I'm going to do it. Like,
Well, I gave Far Cry 3, actually, and I still got flack for it. It's not such a safe score after all.
There's two final things, like, sorry, Marshall.
Go for it.
This could go on for a while, couldn't it?
No, the internet has caused problems because a lot of people who read reviews now are drive-by readers who don't necessarily engage with the same brand over and over again, and therefore brands lose their context. Like, the magazine cultures that you have with NME and things are out of context all the time for most of the people who stumble across reviews. And they have no sense of that, and there's no way for them to quickly get it, and so they leap at the score and they assume some internal, they judge the score as some internal measure instead of the measure of the thing they're reading. Second thing is, if you're an executive and you're making hiring and firing decisions or pay rise decisions or bonus decisions based on Metacritic, you're incompetent and you're making decisions based on bad data.
Yeah, exactly. Consensus in the games industry, when it occurs, is not statistically significant either. That's the other thing. People often compare, like, the Metacritic as delivered by critics with the Metacritic score as delivered by users. And what you're comparing is 60 reviews there against millions of reviews. And there is going to be a statistical disparity, because it's quite easy within the history of the games industry for 60 journalists to hand in scores within, you know, 20 points of each other. That's not That's not a kind of mystery cabal. That's just...
I think humans are predisposed to suspect mystery cabal.
Yeah.
But mystery cabal not happen.
Not the mystery cabal again.
Yeah. But it doesn't even happen that often. Like, Bioshock probably was one of the few recent games which has had, like, an unusually uniform set of review scores from the... from the ones that appear on Metacritic, anyway.
Mm. Mm. I think, I mean, but, you know, I think genuinely, like, that was an instance where that game is hard to review. I think Tom did a great job.
Thanks,
Tom. But because you focused on mechanically what was good about it, right? Like, but also acknowledged the issues and gave a score that reflected that balance, again, as with Far Cry. But, you know, obviously reviewing that game asks you to handle the fact that it's the most schizophrenic game in probably recent memory in terms of the things it's about. Because it's about Creedence Clearwater Revival, grappling hooks, racism, and time travel. Right? There you go. Like, it, you know, doesn't make any sense. And so asking someone to kind of say, objectively, we're going to measure this, it's 6.5, is nonsense. It's always going to be, in that case, even more of a subjective thing. And people are probably going to, given how impressive that game is on so many different levels, lean higher in that case, if only out of kind of bafflement.
I think we talked about this stuff before, about the disparate nature of games and how games are not only experiential, artistic, cultural artifacts, they're also mechanical in some way. I think it was Tom that said that they're cars full of art.
Cars full of paintings.
Yeah, cars full of paintings. And in that context, then, yeah, you're critiquing the handling, you're critiquing how nice the doors feel to close, and then you're looking around yourself going, well, I've not crashed and died yet, so that's an improvement. How do I feel about one of these paintings? One of which is cubist, and one of which is...
All right, except for the cubist painting. Drives well, bad cubism.
Hilkstrom asks... Dear CNC, what are your opinions on games now becoming service platforms instead of static finished products?
It's interesting. I think it's good in general. But it's fucking up all our language and all of our ability to rate these things and our ability to do a game of the year thing, for example. Yeah. Basically, I used to be a bit skeptical about it. I used to feel like the sort of the paid beta thing, because I was a journalist at the time, and I was sort of, you know, getting into development and thinking about how I would behave as a developer. I felt like, as a journalist, they sort of hoodwinked us in a way that they'd, like, just by putting this tag on it, they said, you're not allowed to review this thing. We're allowed to charge people money for it, but you can't pass a judgment on it. And we had situations where we'd, you know, review something because you can buy it. And then our readers would complain to us that we're giving them buying advice on a thing that is not final, even if it's being charged money for. They're like, it's not fair to review it because it's not final. And, you know, we're doing it because they need the advice. We thought it would be helpful to them since someone's asking them money for a product or service, and we thought we'd evaluate the worth of that proposition. But they hate it. And so I was thinking, like, it was weird they... These evil developers are getting away with this terrible scam they're doing of just saying it's beta and then it suddenly is okay to charge money for it and they can't ever be criticized for any problems, but they still get credit if it's good. And then I kind of realized that, well, that word is not nothing. Like, the people who are buying it know the word. They know what it means. And the reason they feel like it's unfair to criticize it in that state is because they knew it was alpha when they bought it and they knew there'd be bugs. And in fact, in stuff like Prison Architect, they advertise the bugs. Like, their marketing strategy is basically, most of their public tweets are like, here's the latest crazy bug in our game that you can pay, like, quite a lot of money for. It's quite an expensive game. Like, here's what's going horribly wrong in it today, and it's crazy shit. If a prisoner is on the toilet when it's time for release comes, he's stuck on the toilet forever. Not only can he never leave prison, he can't even leave the toilet. And, yeah, so I suddenly realised, well, actually, you know, people get what that word means, and it's okay. As long as they understand that, as long as your thing is clear that you're selling them a thing that has bugs and problems and is in development.
DayZ, the alpha version that just came out, the screen, the pop-up screen that tells you that this is a game that's still in development and may have lots of bugs, it's totally fucked all the text.
Well, you can't read it, but you get the message.
Which is hilarious. And kind of indicative of the state of alpha or something.
I guess this questioner is also asking about kind of after it is released, the sort of ongoing service nature. I guess we've covered that pretty well with Dota and TF2 in terms of what how cool it can be when it's done well.
I loved the idea of games as services when it was like Team Fortress 2 and Dota. Now it's alpha stuff. I'm a little bit more wary because there is just everything's coming out on early access now. Alpha games are everywhere. The idea of your game being released now is just meaningless. And a lot of the stuff that's been put out is quite shite. I agree with you though that the buyers, the people who are playing these games are smarter than we sometimes give them credit for. And it was interesting when I was talking to developers about this who were releasing alpha games, and the developers were saying, yeah, of course you should review our alpha game. We're charging money for it. We want you to review it. Of course you should review it. What they didn't like was that necessarily we would put a score on it, which is relevant to our previous discussion, partly because Metacritic will take the first score you put out and then refuse to ever change it. And that doesn't make a big difference, but also because scores are the thing that's seen as final. They're totally fine with you providing 1,000 words of buyer's advice that says, this is fucked, don't ever buy it. But don't put a number at the end of it. And that was interesting. And yeah, the readers just go apeshit if you do as well. So that was educational.
I also, as a developer, it sort of, it started as kind of the way to do it now. You make it as a service, not a single product, and keep updating it forever and cultivate this community. And I just bought into that because I believe everything Valve says. And, obviously they're super smart, and I've been fans of games that do that, and I've liked it. And then, now I suddenly realize as a developer, like, Christ, I don't want to do that. Like, you look at, I follow Gary on Twitter, Gary's Mod Fame, and he, like, releases a patch and then just gets a message saying, if you don't revert the patch, I will find you and cut your throat in the night. And we seem to like the COD weapon change where the guy was sending death threats and stuff. The more you make it a service, the more people threaten to kill you. And also you have to work on the same fucking thing forever, which is not that much fun.
The flip of that, though, is that Gary's Mod's best-selling month ever was September.
Yeah.
Which it sold more than twice what it had in any other month ever. And it just, the curve is just exponentially increasing. Like, it is just exponential.
With infinity money comes infinity death threat.
That's actually true. That's how it works. Scoo asks, five of you, Dota o'clock. I want Chris to sign each of you five, each of the five with their own Dota hero. Dota. Selection criteria, up to him.
Okay. Luckily for everybody involved, I thought about this in advance. I think it is actually possible to select heroes for everybody in this room that are not only appropriate to them as people, but actually formed quite a viable competitive team. Okay. So I'm, for myself, I'm actually going to give myself my favorite hero in the game, Storm Spirit. Natural mid laner, requires a little bit of farm early in order to snowball late, a kind of avuncular, alcoholic thespian lightning god, whose only real weakness is being silenced for any protracted period of time. on the safe lane, on the farming lane initially, a hard carry would be Tom Senior, because I think you probably don't take very much shit from games. You probably don't want something a little bit too complicated. You want to hit people really hard.
That sounds about exactly right.
So for you, we'd go for Sven.
Okay.
Who is like a swordsman with a huge two-handed sword, whose abilities are basically limited to yelling so that he can go faster, yelling so that he can do double damage, and throwing a massive hammer at people.
No, this sounds perfect.
Yeah, okay. But you require a little bit of support in order to have an early game that is viable and to snowball a little bit later on. But you've got Martin, who would be Venomancer.
Venomancer?
Who is a kind of like a botanist that was accidentally fused with a deadly orchid and a snake.
That's what happened to Martin in his graveyard recently.
Into a creature of pure poison. Whose specialty is gobbing at people, creating tentacles that gob at people, which I was thinking was be a euphemism for your love of drawing cocks. and his ultimate basically just guffs poison in every direction, ruining,
I ventilated this flat thoroughly before you arrived. You would not know how appropriate that was.
Perfect. On the off lane, would be a solo off lane because Thomas is quite a solitary gamer.
True.
Independent.
Don't play Dota, that's for sure.
Solo offlane Bounty Hunter, who's a kind of like stealth assassin character, just doubles down on the Tom Francis Master of Stealth kind of thing. But there's a number of them. The particular reason Bounty Hunter is, Bounty Hunter's ultimate track allows him to shoot a kind of a dart at an enemy that allows you to see wherever they run on the level. But more importantly, it also places a bounty on that character, which means when that character dies, he gets much more money from it. So Bounty Hunter very rapidly exceeds the wealth curve of every other character in the game. Or has the potential to, anyway.
That's the aspect of my personality you focused on.
There's two things. There's two different aspects to that. Finally, Graham, I think, would probably go into the jungle. And there's a few options, and I kind of told you a few, but I think at the end of the day, Graham would probably play Enchantress. Who is a fawn, like a lady with a deer's body, who initially in her early game will farm by enchanting like centaurs or bears and things in the forest and making them fight each other.
Graham does do that.
Yeah. in a kind of, you know, your enthusiasm for life sims and also perhaps also like Animal Crossing and Pokemon. But however, but also is the personality of the character is very much kind of unfazed and almost unfazable by anything that's happening. She has a nice time, whatever's sort of going on. Can summon a little cloud of fairies that repair her. But her ultimate will completely fuck people up because it means that the further she is away from someone when she throws a spear, the more damage it does. And so therefore from this sort of innocent kind of cuddly monsters fighting monsters beginning ends up fucking terrifying after maybe 20 minutes. Okay. And that would be the Crate and Crowbar Dota team.
Yeah, everyone knows what this means. We have to do this. And we have to record
it'd be a complete disaster. The thing is, mid lane is actually quite a good place for me to be because I'd be I'd be nowhere near any of you. Therefore,
run away.
We'll be able to see what we're doing wrong all the time. All the many millions of
But I wouldn't be there in your lane going, Tom, why?
Yeah.
I think it's probably left in the imaginations of the people. But, if you want to, totally down for that. I'm playing Dota anyway.
We can give it a go once, I imagine.
It could be hilarious.
Is that all the time we have?
That's all the time we have.
I think that's all the time we have.
That's the end of 2013.
Gosh. Lord.
We should probably explain why that is.
Because we're not returning until the new year. We all have holidays and stuff to do.
Yeah.
Families to see. Dogs to pet in some cases.
Mm.
We're not quite sure exactly when we'll return in January, but probably early-ish.
Early-ish in January, because not only there's Christmas, but then there's your house move, Martin, which is going to
disrupt things
a little bit, but bear with us.
But in the meantime, you can always visit our forums and hang out with the cool people there, which you can access from crateandcrowbar.com, and maybe even buy some t-shirts if you liked while you're there.
Martin would like that.
I would like that.
Warm during those chilly
keep you somewhat
Christmas
warm
times.
Also, on the subject
somewhat
of
warm indoors.
Wear all of them. Buy all of them and wear all of them simultaneously. And then, with your bare arms, tie other t-shirts that you've also bought from us around then.
Don't. The last thing we need is a tragedy. I was also going to say that, based on some enthusiasm on the forums already, my kind of idea for a Dota Guild about getting new people into the game is going to happen over this Christmas break.
Really?
Absolutely. Awesome. Probably this weekend.
I'm presuming you'll find more details of that
on the forum. Right. There'll be a dedicated thing for it on the forum very soon indeed.
Well, it's called Lukewarm Dukes.
So the structure will be Hot Dukes.
Right.
Everyone is a Hot Duke. But how much experience you have with Dota will depend on the size of Duke you are. So rather than measure people from cold to hot, it'll be from little to big.
Okay.
People with a lot of experience will begin as big Dukes or even mega Dukes. Whereas people on the little end might be like micro jukes, mini jukes, and so on. Sometimes in jokes get out of control. And,
that's how podcasts are formed.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
But our email won't shut down over Christmas. If you want to send us more questions, we will be able to look at them in January. You can do so by sending that to questions@crateandcrowbar.com. Or you can tweet us @crateandcrowbar. Or you can tweet us individually. I'm @MarshDavis.
I'm @Pentadact.
I'm @PCGLudo.
I'm @CThurston.
And I am @Gunnis.
Merry Christmas, everybody!